Full committee hearing on the House Veterans Affairs Committee, July 27, 2005, will come to order. Today, the committee is meeting to examine efforts of the Department of Defense and Veterans Affairs to identify recent combat service members at risk for post-traumatic stress disorder, hereinto referred to as PTSD, including Reserve and National Guard members, and to assess their capabilities to meet an increase in demand for PTSD-related services from Operations Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom. The wounds of wartime service are not always as visible as those caused by a bullet or shrapnel. Wounds to the mind and spirit, however, are just as serious and demand every bit of much care and attention. We have, since the days when it was called shell shock, learned much about PTSD. Yet we have much more to learn so that we can accurately diagnose and effectively treat it. Perhaps there are ways that we can prepare our young warriors before they deploy so that they will be less vulnerable to the trauma. These are things we must learn more about so that we can take appropriate action. Recently, the VA Inspector General report indicated that waiting times for health care appointments have been underreported, and we owe our veterans better, regardless of the burdens of their service that they bear. I also will note, and I'm hopeful that the witnesses today will, I've read your statements last night, so I want to bring this up, and hopefully you can address this in your testimony. This recent IG report that was examining the state variances in VA disability compensation payments noted some real significant numbers, and that it is rather alarming, and I welcome the comments from the experts here today. During fiscal years 1999 to 2004, the number and percentage of PTSD cases increased significantly. Now, this is from the IG report dated May 19, 2005. While the total number of all veterans receiving disability compensation grew by only 12.2%, the number of PTSD cases grew by 79.5%, from 120,265 cases in FY 1999 to 215,871 cases in FY 2004. During the same period, PTSD benefit payments increased 148%, from $1.7 billion to $4.3 billion. Compensation for all other disability categories only increased by 41%, while veterans being compensated for PTSD represented 8.7% of all compensation recipients. They're receiving 20.5% of all compensation payments. That's a wow. It's a distortion also in the compensation system. And I don't understand the reasons of what's happening out there, and I welcome the input from the experts on this today. And we may even have to do follow-up with regard to this. I now yield to my ranking member, Mr. Evans, for his opening remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for holding this hearing. It's really important to hear from these witnesses today. I hope we can move forward quickly on legislation to ensure that the VA and DOD are taking steps to address mental health care needs for returning servicemen and women. I also want to thank Ms. Stephanie Pelka for her service to our country in the Army Reserve and for her husband, Michael's honorable service. We owe so much to you, ma'am. That we can never repay for the suffering that you've lost. In her statement, she testifies that she told her husband's story, and it indicated to me the truth of the perception among veterans that the wars don't end when they are not over, that their service to this country demands that they get the help that they need, the compensation, pension programs, and educational benefits, and the GI Bill benefits. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your yielding me the time.
Thank you. My colleagues, our colleague from Texas, Judge Ted Proe, wanted to be here to introduce his constituent who will testify next to us. And if you may indulge, rather than take his statement and submit it, if I may read the introduction of the constituent, our first witness. This is the statement on behalf of our colleague, Ted Poe of Houston, Texas. Quote, I want to thank Chairman Buoyer and Ranking Member Lane Evans for holding this important hearing on a problem that impacts all of our communities. Stephanie Pilkey is a constituent of mine from Spring, Texas. She was a captain in the Army where she served with her husband, Captain Michael John Pilkey. Today, Stephanie Pilkey will tell you the story of her husband, a man whom she loved and loved his country, and how he was a changed man when he came back from Iraq. She would talk about their experience as they tried to deal with her husband's emotional turmoil, and she will talk about how post-traumatic stress disorder hurt both the patient and everyone within their circle of friends and families. Her story is an important story as it serves to underline an important and growing problem as more and more of our armed forces members return from combat with injuries, not all of which are physical, and turn to the VA and DOD for assistance. Ms. Pilkey, you are recognized and may take as much time as you like.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Evans, and other members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Pilkey, and I am a former captain in the U.S. Army. This testimony is on behalf of my husband, Captain Michael John Pilkey, who died on November 5, 2004. Although he was a brave veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, he did not die in battle, at least not in Iraq. He died in a battle of his heart and mind. He passed away in our home at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, from a gunshot wound to the chest. My Michael was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, only 1 week before his death by a licensed therapist authorized by TRICARE. The official ruling by the Department of Defense is suicide. However, many people, including myself, believe it may have been a horrible accident. We also believe that he would not have been sleeping with a loaded weapon if it weren't for PTSD. When I met my husband, he was responsible and hardworking. He loved life, traveling, and having fun. He hailed from Walcott, Connecticut, and was one of six siblings. He received his commission from the University of Connecticut. Being a soldier was a childhood dream for him. We were married in November 2001, and our journey as a military family began. Michael deployed for Iraq with the 1st Armored Division in late March of 2003, 3 weeks after our son Benjamin was born. He left a happy and proud father. He returned in late July 2003. It seemed upon his return that our family was complete and that we had made it through our first real-world deployment. He seemed so happy to be home. A few days after returning to Germany, he reported to his primary care physician on July 28, 2003, as part of a post-deployment health assessment. He expressed concerns to his primary care physician that he was worried about having serious conflicts with loved ones. The physician referred him to see a counselor. However, the mental health staff on our post was severely understaffed with only one or two psychiatrists. Michael was unable to get an appointment before we moved from our post in Germany to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. He noted several concerns on his DD Form 2796 post-deployment health assessment. However, the most worrisome notation from this form was the admission of feeling down, depressed, and sometimes hopeless. He also noted that he was constantly on guard and easily startled after returning from his deployment. When we got to Fort Sill, we both settled into our assignments. Everything seemed normal for a while. 6 months later, the symptoms of PTSD started to surface, only we did not know enough about PTSD to connect the dots. When my husband returned from Iraq, there were no debriefings for family members, service members, or forced evaluations from Army Mental Health in Germany. As a soldier and wife, I never received any preparation on what to expect upon my husband's return. I believe that it is crucial that spouses be informed about the symptoms of PTSD. Spouses are sometimes the only ones who will encourage a soldier to seek help. Most soldiers I know will not willingly seek help at any military mental facility for fear of repercussions or even jibes from fellow soldiers. After months arriving in Oklahoma, there were several instances in which I would find a fully loaded 9mm pistol under Michael's pillow or under his side of the bed. I could not seem to get through to him that having this weapon was not necessary and it posed a danger to our family. Michael finally agreed to put his pistols away. I thought the situation was resolved. As a soldier myself, I could understand that having a weapon after being in a war might somewhat be habitual for him. Little by little, other symptoms started to arise, including forgetfulness, chest pains, high blood pressure, and trouble sleeping. Remembering to mail bills and recalling simple things became a great problem for him. One of the greatest tests PTSD posed to our marriage was that Michael began to suffer from erectile dysfunction, which would cause him to break into tears. He did not understand what was happening. I did not know what was happening to my husband. On other occasions, he would overreact to simple things. One night, we heard something in the garage. It was still light outside. Michael proceeded to run outside with a fully loaded weapon and almost fired at a neighbor's cat. These overreactions occurred on several occasions. These symptoms would come and go to a point that they didn't seem like a problem at the time. There were times that everything seemed just right in our home, and he seemed capable enough. He was succeeding in his career as the only captain in research and development unit at Fort Sill. It was the job in which he was entrusted with researching and contributing to the Army's latest in targeting developments. We soon bought a new house, and he was so proud of it. We were finally getting settled. Finally, the nightmares began. This would be the last symptom of PTSD to arise, and it was the one symptom that I feel ultimately contributed to my husband's death. These nightmares were so disturbing that Michael would sometimes kick me in his sleep or wake up running to turn on the lights. He would wake up covered in sweat, and I would hold him until he went back to sleep. He was almost childlike in these moments. In the morning, he would joke around, and sadly, we both laughed it off. However, at this time, I do want to point out that Michael was seeking help for all of these symptoms I have discussed. He was put on high blood pressure medication. He also complained of chest pains and was seen on 3 occasions in the month preceding his death. He even sought a prescription for Viagra to ease marital tensions. However, no military physician ever saw Michael could give him any answers. No doctor ever asked him about depression or linked his symptoms to the war. Michael tried to seek help from the Fort Sill Mental Health Facility, but was discouraged that the appointments he was given were sometimes a month away. So he called TRICARE and was told that he could receive outside therapy if it was family therapy. So we took it. Family therapy, marital counseling, or whatever they wanted to call it. We were desperate to save our marriage. After all, the symptoms of PTSD were causing most of our heartache. In the 2 weeks prior to his death, we saw a therapist as a couple and individually. This therapist told Michael that he had PTSD and that she would recommend to his primary care provider that he be put on medication. He was so excited and expressed to me that he could see a light at the end of the tunnel. He finally had an answer to all of his problems and some of our marital troubles. It was an exciting day for us, not to mention 2 weeks before his death, he interviewed for a position in which he would be running the staff of a general officer. He was beaming with pride. He met with a therapist on a Monday. Tuesday, we celebrated our 3rd wedding anniversary. It was a happy time. I felt hope and relief with the recent positive events. Michael must have felt something else. Friday, my parents were visiting. I was at a church function, and my father returned from playing golf to find Michael. He looked as if he were sleeping peacefully, except for the wet spot on his chest. His pain was finally over, and his battle with PTSD was won. No, he wasn't in Iraq. but in his mind he was there day in and day out. Although Michael would never discuss the details of his experiences in Iraq, I know he saw casualties, children suffering, dead civilians, and soldiers perish. For my soft-hearted Michael, this was enough. Every man's heart is different. For my Michael, it may not have taken much, but it changed his heart and his mind forever. My husband served the Army and his country with honor. He was a hard worker, wonderful husband and father. He leaves behind a 28-month-old son, Benjamin. One day I would like to tell my son what a hero his father was. He went to war and came back with an illness. Although PTSD is evident in his medical records and in my experiences with Michael, the Army has chosen to rule Michael's death a suicide without documenting the serious illness. I have been told by the investigator that PTSD diagnoses must be documented by Army mental health psychiatrists to be considered valid. At the time, Michael sought help. He knew it was an urgent matter and was not willing to wait a month or even a few days. We accepted the help TRICARE offered us, and now Michael is not going to get the credit that he deserves. Why pay outside mental health providers to care for our soldiers if their diagnoses are not considered valid? He is a casualty of war. I have heard this spoken from the mouths of two generals. He came home with an injured mind, and to let him become just a suicide is an injustice to someone who served their country so bravely. He loved being a soldier, and he put his heart into it. I will be submitting petitions to have PTSD officially documented and to have my husband put on the official Operation Iraqi Casualty of War list. There are so many soldiers who have committed suicide due to PTSD in Iraq and received full honors and benefits without an official PTSD diagnosis. Michael deserves the same honor. If only the military community at that time had reached out to family members in some manner to prepare them for and make them aware of the symptoms of PTSD, my family's tragedy could have been averted. So many soldiers are suffering from this disorder, and so many families are suffering from the aftermath of this war. I don't want my Michael to have died in vain. He had a purpose in this life, and that was to watch over his soldiers. I intend to keep him. Helping him do so by spreading our story. He suffered greatly from the classic symptoms of PTSD. It is plain to see in retrospect. His weapon became a great source of comfort for him. He endured sleepless nights due to nightmares and images of suffering that only Michael knew. My husband died of wounds sustained in battle. That is the bottom line. And the war does not end when they come home. Thank you.
Spilky, thank you for sharing your story. It takes courage for you to sit there and share it publicly, but I know you do that on behalf of your husband. You're telling his story, and I think it's extremely important. Sitting to your left is your congressman, Congressman Ted Poe, and he was caught with the president, but I'm glad you've now arrived. I want you to know, Congressman Poe, I read your introduction of your constituent into the record. But I'll yield to you for any comments that you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for having this hearing. Besides the fact that Ms. Pelkey is a constituent of mine, a little more background about her. She's graduated with an associate degree from the New Mexico Military Institute in Roswell, New Mexico, and back in 1996, and went on to graduate and receive her commission as a second lieutenant from the New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And then after graduating officer's basic course, Ms. Pelkey received her first assignment as the battalion chemical officer for the 1st 94th Field Artillery Battalion in Germany. It is important to note that she was the first woman to serve in this field artillery battalion and one of the first three women in Germany to ever be placed in an all-male combat arms unit. After she met her husband, they were married on November the 2nd, 2001. And their son Benjamin was born on March 15, 2003 in Germany. Her second assignment was as the Brigade Chemical Officer for the 75th Field Artillery Brigade at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. She left the Army and ended her time in service in September of 2004. And her husband, Michael, died on November the 5th, 2004. And I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for having this hearing, and I also want to thank Ms. Pelkey for her moving testimony. I yield back. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Pelkey, your pain will last for some time. And I think as those of us here, as listening to your story, we seek to empathize and sympathize with your position. I could not help reflect upon my my best friend, who was 16, took his own life with a pistol. And his baseball cap sits behind my desk so I can look at it every day. And a lot of people will walk into my office and they think probably it's my baseball cap, but it's my best friend. And you know, I have, for the last 27 years, when I think of him, I will think of why and what could I have done to prevent it. And it's going to happen to you. And you're going to do that through your mind. Did I do all that I should have done? Now, when you have been doing that, what is important for us, though, is not so much for you to place that burden upon yourself. You're going to. I do, and will continue to. What could I have done? But let me shift it. You touched on the fact that your husband sought treatment, but there was an access problem. Can you develop that a little more for us to understand? Because here, those of us have oversight over the VA. The reason we've asked the military to come here is that these soldiers, they transition, as you know, from the military to veteran status. We in the VA also care for some of the active duty in our system, and then they transition back, and we get reimbursed for that care. So this transition, we are trying to make sure that health care is seamless, so that when you find yourself in a position that is very challenging, help us understand where, in your mind, when you play this back, where did the system break down and where should the help have been?
I want to point out that at this time that my husband was redeployed back to Germany was in the very early stages of them even bringing people back from Iraq. I think they were more, or the Army was more on a level of preparing for units to come back at that time and not individual soldiers. They did have the post-deployment health assessment in place, and the doctors did refer him to see mental health. But I think the breakdown in the system overall for my husband was the lack of staff at the mental health facility in Germany at that time. And I know there have been improvements since. But also, when he was seen at Fort Sill, there was no system in place for when these symptoms arise, for the primary care providers, the nurses, the doctors, to recognize these symptoms. They should be able to trigger some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, or referral when they see some of these symptoms, and that's just not in place to my knowledge. And I think that's where my husband really lost out, was that they just didn't recognize the physical symptoms.
So the doctors were treating the physical symptom. I mean, they were being very narrow rather than taking it to a PTSD level.
Right.
How many doctors did he see, do you recall? How many different medical doctors at Fort Sill?
He saw his primary care provider, who consulted with the same physician each time. And I can tell you there were about 7 or 8 different visits for chest pains, high blood pressure, erectile dysfunction, and even noted depression.
At any time, did you think or suspect PTSD?
No, I did not suspect PTSD. I didn't really know anything about it at that point. I think that my husband and I thought that we were just going through marital problems.
So when's the first time you heard PTSD?
I heard of PTSD shortly before my husband died, when he was diagnosed by his outside provider.
And who was the outside provider?
She was a therapist. Her name was Joni Saylor, and she was an off-post provider that generally TRICARE sends the soldiers to for treatment.
So she's a civilian therapist. Is she a doctor?
She's a civilian therapist. She's an MA. She's a licensed therapist.
So Fort Sill, maybe that's a question for Fort Sill. Do you know how many referrals at all were you, were there others that you knew that were going into the, being referred to TRICARE?
I know that, I mean, from general knowledge that the Army as a whole is having problems with marriage in general, divorce rates and everything. So I can imagine that there are plenty of people that are being seen. Oh,
That's right. You got there through family therapy was the access, because you weren't getting that access from the military.
Yes, sir.
Wow.
We had the opportunity to, but like I said, my husband was not willing to wait. I think at that point he knew that we needed to do something immediately, and he was not willing to wait the amount of time which was given to him, which was a month.
You know, in the military, we talk about the Army family, right? The Army of One. And somewhere in there's a breakdown in that, in the family there to help take care of our own. I mean, that's my sense by your story here. And that's very bothersome to me. Let me yield at this time to Mr. Filner for any questions he may have. You're now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for having this hearing, and thank you for scheduling Mrs. Pelkey here with us. That's very. I think we're all affected. Mrs. Pelkey, I appreciate your courage and your willingness to do this in public. It's very important. I'm glad there were people from the DOD and VA here to hear it. I don't know if you've tried to talk to them, go up that chain of command, but maybe I'm glad they heard it. We talk a lot. We argue about numbers here. We don't have $1 billion enough, $2 billion, you know. But it gets down to whether we have the services for people like you and your husband, and we simply don't. And I think it all, you know, I've been yelling a lot, myself and others have, about the lack of resources, but it comes down to being able to get the help. Appointments not being available, have to wait. It's not just statistics. I mean, it's human beings here, and you've pointed that out. It seems to me, again, first of all, you made a very powerful statement about families being educated. I mean, that's rather a obvious and fairly simple thing in essence. If the Army, you know, and other defense agencies recognized it. I mean, we have gone through, we've seen it with our atomic veterans, our Agent Orange from Vietnam, PTSD. At first, nobody wanted to recognize it. They said, you know, just, as the chairman said, it's shell shock or it's in your head, you know, and we keep denying it. There's an institutional, it looks to me, dynamic to deny these things. Maybe it's because it's going to cost money, I don't know, or they don't want to admit mental problems on the behalf of our brave young men and women. But the outreach to families, the outreach to soldiers coming back has to be incredibly expanded. And I think you would agree with me that, I mean, once you knew, if you had known this from the beginning, you could have pressed for the proper attention. And even if you press for that, by the way, I could tell you there's not enough resources now anyway. And for some reason, the VA is still messing around with a model, a mathematical model to tell us how many people are going to have mental health problems. Well, I would assume everybody's going to and talk to everybody, and then, you know, you put the folks who need it into medical care when they return. So it just doesn't seem to me they're recognizing it still. You have an important role to play. I hope we can work with you to do that. Even with your knowledge now of PTSD, if your husband was not diagnosed as a PTSD, a service connected, there's no provision for services anyway, is there? I mean, if something happened, let's say more than two years down the line, if these symptoms became graver then, he would have had the same problems. Is that your sense of it?
He would have had the same problems, but I do want to make very clear that I have seen with my own eyes that after my husband's death, that the Army became very proactive on the Fort Sill community. They started a program there that has just grown, and they're not waiting around for any models to come out. They're trying to see what works for the soldiers, and they have some very low budget programs that are working wonderfully for the soldiers. There are group therapies. There are things out there that are working that don't cost a whole lot of money, and they're working. Soldiers don't want to see PowerPoint presentations. They don't want to see videos. They want to be in a safe environment. They want to talk with one another, just as I know in my experiences talking to Vietnam veterans and other war veterans, that they feel safe amongst themselves talking about it. And this is what they've done at Fort Sill. They've modeled a program to integrate the soldiers in wherever they're comfortable. They go into motor pools wherever they have to, and they're talking to the soldiers, and then the soldiers that have apparent problems are put into group sessions, and they talk, they joke around, and then they really get down to the problems that they have. And this is what's working from what I've seen. So there are things out there that are being done.
I think we know how to deal with it if we put the resources in. Do you think the families, whether it's the spouses or the children, are getting, while the service members deployed, that's when some education should be done? Is that being done also at Fort Sill? No.
They have a very strong pre and post deployment program there now. I mean, yeah, it did take a loss, or maybe even, you know, a couple of losses. Right. But the command has been very proactive there. They now brief spouses, and they're starting a program for children where they even sit the children down and tell them, you know, these are the things that scare mommy or daddy. These are the things that slamming doors, and they try to educate the children, and they're trying their hardest. But it's crucial, I think, to educate the spouses, because spouses, whether they're male or female, are ultimately the ones that are going to push their spouse to go and get help, whether it's because of marital tension or, you know, just they're the ones that are going to urge the soldier to go.
I've sat into some of the PTSD discussions. They're very powerful, and I just hope what you're describing at Fort Sill keeps going even after a change of command. Sometimes these things are personally driven as opposed to institutionally driven, and what you've taken as your job and which we want to support you at is to get all this institutionalized, provide whatever money is needed. We've seen what happens in Vietnam. If you don't treat the mental state, you know, half of the people on the streets today are Vietnam vets, and that's partially because we didn't take it very seriously.
Thank you.
And we see it happening again, and I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Mr. Filner, for your contribution. Now I recognize Mr. Michaud. Ma'am, he's the ranking member on our health subcommittees in the state of Maine.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Chairman. I'd ask unanimous consent for my full opening statement to be submitted for the record.
No objections, so ordered.
Also, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask that testimony from the National Mental Health Association be also entered into the record.
We have an entire list when I get to the end that will be submitted.
Okay.
They are on the list.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Pelkey, first of all, I want to thank you for your courage and your willingness to come before this committee and share your experience. It is tragic what happened to your husband, but your willingness to speak out will help many other families who will face the challenges of caring for a family member with a PTSD. Many American military families are in your debt for your testimony here today, and for that, I want to thank you for that testimony, because unfortunate that it happened, but I think hopefully we'll learn from it and be able to help others. I just have one question. In your testimony, you indicated that you would like your husband to be recognized as a casualty of combat. Has the Army explained to you the process of which you can petition to have your husband acknowledged as a casualty of war?
The fact that it's not being recognized in his file, in his case file, is one reason that the subject has never come up between myself or a casualty officer. So it hasn't been discussed yet. It's something I would like to do because I believe that it will open the door to this being recognized as a wound of war and for them to be recognized as casualties. And they've already done so in recognizing one soldier that I know of. His name is Master Sergeant Coons from Katy, Texas. Mm-hmm. He, his family submitted a petition to have him recognized as a casualty of war. He was, he committed suicide at Walter Reed in their outpatient. I don't believe it was a care facility. It was like a motel room, outpatient living quarters. And they successfully had him put on the casualty of war list. They have opened the door for this to be recognized. And I would like to have my husband also on the casualty of war list, because I truly, with all my heart, believe that I have the medical evidence and just my own experiences that he suffered from this disorder, and it will open the door further for other soldiers to be recognized and for the illness to be taken seriously.
Okay. But as of yet, you have not asked, and they have not offered that process to you as of yet.
No one has offered to explain the process, but I also have not inquired about the process.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Michaud, would you yield for a minute?
Yes.
I do have some legislation aimed at Vietnam, but I think it could be expanded here. If you are a casualty, but not from the battle itself, in Vietnam, you can't even get on the wall. And this seems to be the same problem. That is, we are not recognized the heroism because of some bureaucratic sense that, you know, you didn't do it at that moment. And I appreciate your line of questioning. We need to work together to make that happen, both for previous wars and for this.
Thank you, Mr. Filner. At this time, I deal back my time.
I'll be more than generous to give you time for which Mr. Filner had taken from you. All right.
That's great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for arriving late to hear your testimony, but I've had a chance to review your written statement for the record, and I'd like to echo the thoughts of my colleagues here today.
You know
today.
What, Ms. Ruthis? I apologize. You need to.
We should defer
to stand down and
other of my colleagues
really
who have been here a while.
You would defer to your.
That's what I will do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hooley. I think is next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Ms. Pelkey, thank you so much for taking your time to be here. Your story reminds all of us that we need to have a comprehensive approach to addressing mental health needs of our men and women of armed services. With soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, it places a greater burden and demand on our VA hospitals. And I know that it is incredibly important that we have the means necessary to treat our soldiers that are returning. And I'm from Oregon, and from our VA hospital, we have had, because of budget freezes, we've had to reduce the number of therapists. For example, we're about 25% short of therapists in the Portland VA hospital. They've been asked to cut their sessions down from 50 minutes to 30 minutes. They've asked to have a greater length of time between sessions. They've asked to see, well, can you deal with this in 10 sessions? Well, we all know when you have mental health problems, some of those sessions, I mean, sometimes you can deal with it five, sometimes it's going to take 35 or 50, whatever it takes is what we need to be doing. One of the things, because we, in Oregon, we don't have a base, we have a lot of soldiers returning from the military, but a lot of them are Guard and Reserve. And so one of the things we did, because we knew this was going to be a problem, and we brought all of the, everyone involved in the military, we brought employees, our employers, we brought our mental health workers together and said, we need to do more than just a debriefing when the soldiers return. We need to make sure their families are included and that we do this not just the first time when they return, but we do it 3 months, 6 months, because a lot of these problems don't come up until much later. I mean, sometimes it happens 6 months later, sometimes it happens a year later. My question is, you talked a little bit about what resources were available, and if he wanted to get in sooner than a month, he had to go off base. But is there now any place for a spouse to go or a soldier that's returning to just say, hey, something's wrong here. I don't know what it is, but something's wrong. Is there some place you can go now?
Yes, and I apologize for only being able to use Fort Sill as a resource,
right.
But
that's
it's near
and
dear to my heart.
Yeah.
They have done an excellent job in trying to reform their program, and they have also really started to focus on the spouses there. I know that just recently a group of drill sergeants that returned from Iraq were counseled, and out of about 50 drill sergeants, 12 of those needed referrals, as well as they had a session with just the wives of the drill sergeants, and it was just kind of a closed, informal discussion, and that's the way they're approaching it for Fort Sill. It's a comfortable setting. These spouses all had a chance to say, you know, I feel the same way. I feel like my husband's not here anymore. He's disconnected. He doesn't love me. I don't feel pretty anymore. I don't feel wanted by my husband. And they realized, hey, this is not just some kind of divorce phenomenon. It's for a reason. And that's the approach they're taking there. Another point I wanted to make was that the consistency with the care providers, whether they be primary care providers, physicians, or mental health physicians, the soldiers have even said that I see a different person every time. I'd like to see the same person for at least 6 months, for at least a year, the same person who will be able to recall some of the things that I've spoken about, some of the things, the deep personal things that I've shared with them. And the armed services, they're having a problem keeping these contracted people to stay there for that length of time. And it, they need the support. They need the money to keep that consistency, to keep those providers there for up to a year to follow up with these soldiers. And they do need a system of checks and balances. And there are also hotlines that have been set up where even some soldiers can talk directly 24 hours a day to the on-call mental health physician there, and they have actually intervened 20 suicide attempts.
That's really good news. The thing that bothered me most is that if you have to see a different person every time, it seems to me you're telling your story over and over and over again and not making forward progress. Did your husband, when he came back, or did they talk about what signs to look for PTSD?
They did not talk to me as a spouse about it.
Did they talk to him about what you need to look for? Do you know if that happened?
The only counseling my husband got when he came home was, like I said, in the post-deployment health assessment. But they mostly talked about back aches, knee pains. She made a referral to see a mental health physician. But like I said, in Germany at that time, there was only one or two psychiatrists for the Baumholder community.
How long did it take before you or your husband recognized that this was a serious problem? I mean, after you came back, was it a week, a day, 2 months?
Well, initially, he showed signs of anxiety, appetite loss, but these all subsided within weeks. When we got back to the United States, it seemed like they were almost all gone, and everything was back to normal. And 6 months later, everything started to surface in small increments. The pistol, him sleeping with a pistol or carrying a loaded pistol around, lasted for, 1 to 2 months until I finally thought it was resolved. He put him in a high place in his closet. And I thought, okay, well, that's done. Then, a couple of months later, he started having problems with his blood pressure, chest pains, erectile dysfunction. And that's when we thought, okay, well, he has a problem with blood pressure. He got it physically treated with blood pressure medication. The erectile dysfunction caused marital problems.
Right.
But they are also noted physical symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And I truly believe with all my heart that was the root of our marital troubles, family problems. And as a spouse, if I had been informed about these things and I had talked to other women or just a counselor about these things, I think that that not only would I have understood what was going on, I would have urged my husband to get help. And more quickly, and I would not have had the reactions that I did to my husband's problems. When he would forget things, I would yell at him. I would say, how can you forget to mail a bill? You're a captain in the Army. I just don't understand. This is not the same person that left. But I thought something else was wrong with him. I would have never labeled it or known that it was post-traumatic stress disorder. And with the intimacy issues, it's very personal, but it needs to be said. A lot of the soldiers are suffering from intimacy issues with their wives, and I believe it's directly related to the high divorce rate, because that is one of the symptoms, and it does cause problems when you are so consumed with what you saw over there that you can't function with your wife and with your family. Some of the soldiers have even noted that they come home and they send their children to their rooms. They don't want to interact with their families.
Thank you, Ms. Berkley.
Thank you so much for taking your time and your testimony.
Thank you. I now recognize Ms. Berkley. Ma'am, she's our ranking on Disability Assistance Memorial Affairs from the state of Nevada.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mrs. Pelkey, I want to thank you very much for coming here and sharing what is a very intimate tragedy with all of us and with our country. People need to hear these things. While you were speaking, and when I read your testimony last night, I was trying to put myself in not only your husband's place, but in your place. You never know how you're going to react to something unless you're actually thrust into the situation. I grew up during the Vietnam War. I was in high school and college, and so many of the kids that I went to school with to Vietnam came back dramatically changed, and it seems like those that were the most quiet and the most sensitive were the ones that were most traumatically affected by what they saw and experienced over there, and I suspect it's very similar in Iraq right now. What astounds me, and now as a member of Congress, that knowing what transpired in Vietnam with our veterans that returned and knowing the mental problems that they experienced and knowing that so many of our homeless in this country are veterans of the Vietnam War, and I meet with my homeless veterans quite often in Las Vegas, and they're my contemporaries, and you know, you think if not for the grace of God, go I. They went to war as kids, 19, 20, 21 years old, and they came back changed forever. I would have hoped by now that we would not put such a stigma on mental illness as to pretend it doesn't exist or to avert our eyes or don't put the necessary resources so that we can truly holistically treat these men and women that are coming back and help to educate the families that are here so they could recognize the symptoms and get help. So it seems to me from what you were saying and from what I feel is that we need a multi-pronged approach to this, but we need to provide resources so we can counsel the families before their loved ones return so you know what to expect and then put the necessary resources in so we can hire the right amount of professional people that deal with mental illness, because you are quite right. Taking care, providing medication for high blood pressure or providing Viagra for erectile dysfunction is just superficially treating symptoms that aren't really going to get to the core of the problem. So I again, want to thank you for being here and for all of your sacrifice on behalf of this country. And let's make sure that your husband's death is not in vain and that we could help hundreds of thousands of other Americans that are coming home and are suffering needlessly. And if there's any way that we can help and support them, we should be in this with both feet. So thank you very much. And perhaps if I can suggest, and I'm sure your member of Congress already has this in the back of his mind, perhaps you can work with him and make sure that your husband is recognized appropriately. I think we would all be very happy when that happens for you. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berkley. Congresswoman Grace Napoli. You may please come on up here, and you can sit on the other side of Ms. Berkley. This is where Mr. Udall sits. You can join us here on the dais. She is co-chair of the Mental Health Caucus, and we welcome you to the committee. No objection. Pleased for you to join us. Okay. Ms. Herthis, we've been waiting for this.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and in deferring to my colleagues who have certainly shared with our witness today our concern, our empathy for the situation that you face, and our appreciation for your courage and your willingness to share your experiences and how that guides this committee and other members of Congress, Congresswoman Napolitano, and the hard work that she's doing with many of our colleagues with the Mental Health Caucus to eradicate the stigma that Ms. Berkley indicated is a shame still exists. And in your written statement, you had indicated that you sensed, particularly perhaps in the military environment on the base, how that may or may not be exacerbated when one returns and what that means for one's career and the fears that perhaps your husband had in that regard. So I appreciate you being here and working with us to address this issue as a matter of sufficient resources, but also how we go about allocating various resources in ways that are not only going to get at the heart of the problem, but help us to identify what symptoms are becoming manifest sooner so that we can seek treatment that is going to be unique and particular to each individual based on what he or she may be suffering. Just a couple of questions. The first is, you know, some military treatment facilities are using nurses to help manage patients' care. Do you believe that a person whose job it is to look at the whole picture of a patient's care may have helped your primary care doctor to connect the dots of your husband's symptoms and led to an earlier and better treatment of the PTSD from which he suffered?
Yes, I do, and I believe that it is of tremendous importance for not only, I know we've been talking about educating the families and the spouses and the children, but something has to be done also for the medical profession to also help them, because they're overwhelmed. It's a lack of education too there, and a lack of time, and a lack of funding there also. They do the same thing with pregnant women on most military posts. I know when I was in Landstuhl, Germany, I saw a different provider every time, a different healthcare provider every time I was given a screening for my pregnancy. And it's the same thing that's going on with these soldiers. They're seeing someone different every time. They need to see one person that's in charge of everything and is keyed on to these physical symptoms also.
So your sense is that if we're addressing the issue of turnover and the need for the continuity of care, but at the same time looking at individuals that are providing health care to our veterans, perhaps nurses, where we may or may not have as much turnover based on which facility the soldier may be getting treatment, that if we at least in the short term, while we address these issues going forward more effectively, that there needs to be one person that you get to see on a more ongoing basis rather than, as you just described, someone different each time you come in, each week, each month, each 3 months, however frequently one is going to seek the care.
Yes, consistency. So.
And then the last question is, when you completed your service, were you briefed on your VA benefits and resources for your family? Were you aware that the vet centers offer bereavement counseling, and has the vet center in your area been of help to you and your family during your time of grief following your loss?
When I exited the service, of course, my husband was not deceased, but I was given a very intense briefing on my benefits. And I also had help with my disability, with my application for disability. And yes, I have used the grieving services with the VA.
I'm pleased to hear that. Ms. Pelkey, thank you very much for being here today. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And I yield to Mr. Udall.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and appreciate very much the committee focusing on this very important issue. Ms. Pelkey, thank you for your testimony. Clearly, it's very difficult, as all of us can see, for you to tell your husband's story here today. But rest assured, I think with your courage and the courage of others and all of you stepping forward and talking about this, I think it really makes a difference in terms of moving the cause forward. And not only do we hear it, but I think the word spreads to many, many others. I was struck by what you talked about in terms of the contrast between the military and TRICARE, and I think it's what I heard is that it was in TRICARE where this was discovered and was starting to be dealt with. And that tells me a couple of things. One is the military, we're not focusing enough, although there's very hopeful things you've talked about in terms of Fort Sill and the involvement that's going on there. But tell me a little bit about the TRICARE situation and what enabled them to discover what was going on, and did you feel that they were on the right path at the time?
I believe the reason that my husband and I had to seek help from TRICARE is that the military and especially the medical facilities are not receiving the funding and the help that they need to make these diagnoses, to have the consistency that I've been talking about. TRICARE offered marriage or family counseling for my husband and I, and like I said in my testimony, we took it because we felt at that point that our marriage was falling apart and we wanted to save it, and whatever you want to call it. TRICARE sent us to an off-care provider for quote-unquote family therapy. That's what it was coded as, and I think that's where the problem is that a lot of these soldiers are having family problems and family issues connected to post-traumatic stress disorder, which you can directly link to the divorce rates and the suicides. But TRICARE does have the off-post providers, and she did immediately recognize the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. I have a letter that she's written. I just really feel that the military medical community is overwhelmed with not only post-traumatic stress disorder, but with everything that goes along with that, the families, the stress in the families. I mean, so many things. I know as a soldier myself, I could get a same-day appointment to see a military medical doctor. But the problem is that with post-traumatic stress disorder, they just need some help connecting the dots there, some kind of system of checks and balances.
What was the time period from when he was finished the service in Iraq until the actual family therapy, and you started discovering what the problem was?
Well, the symptoms started arising about 6 months after he came back from Iraq, and the family therapy started only 1 week before his death.
Yeah.
So it was a little over a year.
And one of the things that I think you said that was striking about what they're doing at Fort Sill now, involving group therapy and having the soldiers talk with each other, and in the essence of that is really them not feeling that they're alone in these kinds of mental health issues that are coming up. Do you think that knowing what they're doing now and kind of seeing what is happening there at Fort Sill as a result of what they saw happen with your husband, that if he'd had that kind of support, that might have been a much different situation for him, that if they'd spotted it early and given him the opportunity to visit with other soldiers and have a chance to share the things that he was feeling inside, do you think there would have been a different outcome?
I feel like there would have been a different outcome because, like I said, I think the soldiers that have served in Iraq in Operation Enduring Freedom, they have a comfort level amongst each other that is unlike being in front of a counselor or unlike being discussing it with your spouse who has no connection. I mean, even though I was an Army captain myself, I hadn't been to Iraq. So the comfort level still wasn't there between my husband and I. And what they've done at Fort Sill is provide a comfortable environment. They've, I don't even know if this matters, but they provided, you know, comfortable furniture, just kind of like a living room environment for these soldiers to sit down and share their thoughts on it. And there's a moderator for this in which afterwards the soldiers, after they feel comfortable, can come up to that provider and ask for a referral. And that's how they're identifying most of the patients there, is in these group therapy sessions that are being moderated. And then afterwards, they all stand in line and you know, take a questionnaire. But I do feel like this can be brought on a bigger scale. I mean, a facility to deal with post-traumatic stress disorder in the same kind of comfortable environment, I can see it on a bigger scale.
Mrs. Pelkey, thank you very much for your testimony, and we really appreciate you stepping forward on behalf of all veterans that are in a similar situation. Thank you.
I thank the gentleman for his contribution. I'd ask unanimous consent from the members that Grace Napolitano of California, not a member of the committee, be recognized. She would be recognized at the end of all members of the committee having asked questions. And if she would like to ask any questions, she would be recognized at this moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and
hearing
yes,
no
I would.
Hearing no objection, so ordered. You're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the members. I'm very interested in the issue of PTSD for a number of reasons. It has been something that has been long-standing issue with city members of councils throughout the United States, simply because a lot of our soldiers from previous wars have not been able to deal with the issue of PTSD and end up being homeless, and therefore being found in under freeway overpasses and in many areas of especially cities like Los Angeles, where everybody thinks they're just crazy, and there's no way that anybody has been able to address the problem, wrap their arms around it, and be able to really identify what has happened to the individuals who have had a long-standing 20, 30 years of dealing with mental health issues. Excuse me. That said, I have been to both Bethesda and Walter Reed and have visited with some of the soldiers that have returned with disabilities and asked the surgeons in charge whether or not they provide mental health services to the people they're treating. The answer is yes, very, very good services. They also have on the third floor the ability to have a drop-in, daycare, if you will, or day clinics, rather. My concern has been that only those that are identified or self-identified get help. Others go home thinking they can deal with it, that it is something that they can withstand, and eventually it begins to rear its ugly head. Just recently I was traveling to Washington, sitting at an airport next to an individual who bore a pin that I recognized, and we got into a conversation. And he indicated to me, because he asked me what committees I sat on and what I was doing in Washington, and I indicated I was co-chair of the Mental Health Caucus. And he told me a story that kind of set me back, and that was that he was a Vietnam veteran and had 17 jobs in 20 years. Something is wrong, that we are not helping our soldiers be able to cope with it. And besides that, the most important thing, if a soldier's going home to a family, how is that family going to learn how to identify? You're a captain. You were able to understand because at least you've served with part of it, or you've been exposed to it. What about the families that have not? Those that take irrational behavior as something they can no longer tolerate, and so then that individual either gets thrown out or the family moves away and they're left to their own devices. I've had individual VFW groups approach me that now they're seeing soldiers returning, needing help and asking them for help at the VFW and American Legion posts. We are not dealing with it, and my concern has been that we need to not only deal with the actual service to the service individual, but also their families so that they can have a strong support system that can recognize and be able to refer them to adequate assistance, whether through the VA or a local, like a TRICARE, especially if the wife has additional insurance. notwithstanding the fact that our medical institutions do not train doctors to recognize depression and areas that need to be recognized at any level, whether it's a soldier or an individual who suffered trauma, which also is classified as a PTSD. So I'm thankful that you're here, and I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's of grave importance to all of us, and I think that we need to stress the need to expand beyond that scope of service that we are now rendering our service people. And I thank you so very much for being here and for being so open about your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank the gentlewoman for her contribution. I'd like to thank you for coming. And before you leave, would you please introduce the lady who's been accompanying you to your right?
This is my dear friend, Sherry Forbish, who is actually the moderator of my grief group through my church in my hometown. And she's been a tremendous support to me, as well as my Christian church community. She's a wonderful friend.
At any time, did you ever turn to the chaplaincy corps of the Army?
Yes. We did receive or go for marriage counseling twice to a chaplain. However, I do want to say that he was a family friend. So some of the things we were sharing with him were... on a very personal level and just more personal than we would have been with just a counselor, I think.
People know their boundaries, right?
Yes.
Whether it's the chaplaincy, whether it's therapists, whether it's psychiatry, whether it's an MD or internal medicine, everybody knows their boundaries, but they also then do referrals, right? When they know it presses the bounds, then they do that referral. But it didn't seem like did referrals occur here from the chaplaincy to?
No. We, again, saw him for two sessions. And there, of course, were other things discussed. And I think it's a good point, too, that the chaplains need to be educated on this because a lot of soldiers do feel very comfortable with turning to the chaplains. But you also have to remember that chaplains are few and far between. I mean, they're very short-handed on chaplains also.
The point is there are many different entries.
Yes.
Let me conclude with this. Ma'am, you have within your rights to make an appeal through the Surgeon General of the Army with regard to your husband's case. And I would ask you, you have a very able and compassionate congressman there to your left who can also be of assistance to you in that appellate right, and I would encourage you to do that.
Mr. Chairman?
To the search. Mr. Filner?
I just wanted to follow up on that, if I may.
Sure.
With you. Have you met with the Secretary of VA or Secretary of Defense, or have you requested that?
No, sir, I haven't.
Mr. Chairman, I think this committee should work with Ms. Pelkey to try to get those appointments. I think it would be very helpful. As you saw, she's just an incredible source of knowledge and compassion, and I would hope that we could help her to get those appointments. I thank you for yielding.
If I may finish, ma'am, I would encourage you to work with your congressman who understands this process. You are here as a witness of this committee. We will work with him. You do not need an appointment with the Secretary of Defense or with the Secretary of the Army. There are processes for this to occur, and we will work with you to do that. I think what would be helpful here also is I invite you to stay, because we have two more panels that are going to testify, and we're going to hear from the Army. We're going to also hear from experts. And I'd like for you to listen to what they have to say. And then I'd like to come back and speak with you afterwards about your thoughts on what you hear. Will you be helpful to us in that fashion?
Yes, I would be proud to.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
You're now excused. The second panel is, if you please come forward, and when they step up from their seats, ma'am, you can occupy one of theirs. First is Colonel Charles W. Hoag, is an MD, currently directs collaborative research programs to enhance resiliency and reduce the impact of mental disorders among soldiers and their family members. He directs the WRAIR Land Combat Study designed to assess the mental health impact of Operation Iraqi Freedom, OIF, and Operation Enduring Freedom, OEF, and identify new prevention and intervention strategies. Next, we'll hear from Lieutenant Colonel Charles C. Engel, Jr., MD, MPH, is the Assistant Chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the Uniformed Services University and the Director of the Department of Defense Deployment Health Clinical Center at Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. He was the first CAV Division psychiatrist during the 1991 Gulf War, and since then has served as a DOD medical advisor of post-war physical and mental health, particularly as it relates to post-war idiopathic physical symptoms, physical health concerns, and improvement of post-deployment clinical services. We'll then hear from Matthew J. Friedman, MD, PhD. He is the Executive Director of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and Professor of Psychiatry and Pharmacology at Dartmouth Medical School. He has worked with PTSD patients as a clinician and researcher for 30 years and has published extensively on stress and PTSD, biological psychiatry, psychopharmacology, and clinical outcome studies on depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, and chemical dependency. We'll then hear from Alfonso R. Batres, PhD, MMSW. He is the Chief Officer of the Department of Veterans Affairs Readjustment Counseling Service. He has directed oversight of the 206 vet centers providing readjustment counseling service to the war zone veterans nationally. He has held a national and international, he is recognized as a national international leader in pioneering the development and provision of services for veterans with combat-related trauma. Dr. Batres serves as the VA's national, on the VA's National Leadership Board, and is currently extensively working in the VA's response to the needs of returning combat veterans of Iraq, Afghanistan, and the global war on terrorism. We'll then hear from Terrence M. Keene, PhD. Dr. Keene is a professor and vice chairman of research in psychiatry at Boston University of Medicine. He is also the chief psychology and director of National Center for PTSD at VA Boston Healthcare System. The past president for the International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, Dr. Keene has published 3 books and over 140 articles on the assessment and treatment of PTSD. His contributions to the field have been recognized by many honors, and we appreciate you being here today. At this point, I will now yield to Dr. Hoag. You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a great honor.
If you could pull the mic closer to you and turn it on. Thank you.
It's a great honor to be here, and I thank you for the opportunity to discuss the Army's research on PTSD and other mental health issues associated with deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm also grateful for the opportunity that I had to be here for the moving testimony of Mrs. Pelkey and the subsequent questions from the committee. I'm Colonel Hoag. I'm Chief of Psychiatry and Neurosciences at Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. The Army and Department of Defense have taken a proactive approach to understanding and mitigating the mental health concerns associated with deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. We've made it a priority to learn as much as possible and adjust programs as the war is ongoing to meet the needs of our service members and their family members. And your interest in this matter, along with previous support from Congress, has greatly enhanced the body of scientific knowledge. Mental health symptoms are common and expected reactions to combat, and the research following other military combat conflicts has demonstrated that combat exposure confers considerable risk of mental health problems to include PTSD, major depression, substance abuse, and social, family, and occupational problems, as we've heard previously. However, virtually all studies that have assessed the mental health effects of prior combat and prior wars, including the first Gulf War, were conducted years after soldiers returned from the combat zone. To address these concerns, a team of Walter Reed Army Institute of Research, which I'm privileged to lead, initiated a large study in January 2003 with support from senior Army medical and line leaders and Marine line leaders as well, to assess the impact of current military operations on the health and well-being of soldiers and their family members. The study is ongoing, and we've collected over 20,000 surveys to date from soldiers from multiple brigade combat teams deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan, both active component and National Guard, as well as personnel from Marine Expeditionary Forces. We've conducted assessments now out to 12 months after returning from deployment. We published results of our initial findings from 3 months post-deployment in July of 2004. We've also conducted similar assessments in theater as part of the mental health advisory team efforts. Our study has confirmed the importance of PTSD and other mental health concerns associated particularly with deployments to Iraq. Overall, based on our latest findings, 15 to 17% of service members surveyed 3 to 12 months post-deployment met the screening criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, and 19 to 21% met criteria for depression, PTSD, and anxiety. In parallel with our survey-based data, there has also been a substantial increase in military health care utilization and in use of military health services in the military treatment facilities among our OIF veterans. Alcohol misuse, which is also which is strongly associated with PTSD, also has increased post-deployment. Other outcomes that we're looking at include aggression and family functioning, and preliminary data indicates that there are likely deployment-related effects in these areas, similar to what previous studies have shown. The strain of repeated deployments on soldier and family well-being is evident in some units anecdotally. One of the most important findings of our research is what we've learned about barriers to care in the military, particularly stigma. Our study showed that soldiers and Marines are not very likely to seek professional help if they have a mental health problem, and they are concerned that they may be somehow treated differently if they do. Our data has helped us to focus on approaches to facilitate access to care. We're conducting a number of ongoing research projects to improve identification and intervention, reduce stigma and barriers, and our primary focus really is on improving access to care. And we're also attempting to evaluate programs that are being implemented, such as the Department of Defense post-deployment health assessments. Our research has shown that soldiers are much more likely to report their mental health problems 3 to 4 months subsequently after coming home than immediately on their return. And as a result, DOD has expanded the post-deployment health assessment program to include a survey now at 3 to 6 months post-deployment. We're also evaluating interventions such as psychological group debriefings, and we're developing standardized training modules for soldiers, leaders, and healthcare providers. Considerations for improving access to care include co-locating mental health services in primary care clinics. And we heard this morning discussion about the fact that soldiers, virtually all soldiers, access primary care, and this is one portal for soldiers to get help. We want to improve awareness among primary care professionals of depression, PTSD, evaluation and treatment, and it's important to ensure that there's adequate resources to support continued services in the operational setting in Iraq and Afghanistan, as well as to ensure that service members who are identified through our screening programs or who refer themselves receive timely evaluation and treatment. One of the most important aspects of our work is to provide the best interventions within the medical model of care while conveying the message to our service members that many of the reactions that they experience after combat are common and expected. Helping to normalize these reactions is a key to stigma reduction and early intervention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Colonel Engel, you're now recognized.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today and discuss the ways that the Departments of Defense and Army are working proactively to identify and help military personnel with mental illness after service in Iraq and Afghanistan. We appreciate Congress's interest in this topic and this committee's consistent support of DOD and VA mental health. I have three main points. First is the need to bring safe, accessible, and confidential care to service members rather than waiting for them to seek care. Second, primary care affords an excellent opportunity for early recognition and care. And third, many DOD efforts are currently underway to reach out to providers, service members, families, the severely ill, and wounded. I am privileged to direct a unique DOD center of healthcare excellence called the Deployment Health Clinical Center. We began caring for Gulf War veterans in 1994 at Walter Reed. In 1999, we were designated the Deployment Health Clinical Center, and our mission expanded to include provision and improvement of tri-service post-deployment medical care. We have provided care for over 15,000 service members with health concerns following service in various deployments, including Iraq and Afghanistan. We have helped those with both physical and mental wounds. Colonel Hogue tells us mental illness occurs in up to 1 in 4 of those returning from Iraq, with rates rising. A study of injured soldiers evacuated through Walter Reed, led by Captain Tom Grieger, Colonel Steve Koza, shows that about half of those with initial PTSD and depression quickly improve. But overall, rates rise 2 or 3-fold in the next few months. What should we do about this? First, we must provide safe, confidential, and continuous care. We cannot diagnose mental illness simply by looking, and there are no laboratory tests. We must build trust so service members offer frank accounts of their mental state, and we can do accurate screening and provide proper care. Without protection from adverse career actions, mental illness is driven underground. Soldiers keep problems private until they balloon out of control, and we miss opportunities to prevent tragedies and threats to mission success. Second, Colonel Hogue's data reinforced civilian findings that most people with trauma-related mental illness don't receive care. Misconceptions, stigma, and local barriers to care are prevalent. These data compel us to bring services to soldiers rather than waiting for them to seek it. Third, mental illness occurs on a spectrum of severity, and we must provide care to the whole spectrum. A mild definition of PTSD yields rates of pre-war PTSD of nearly 25% and post-war rates over 50%. This tells us that many are distressed after war, and most distress is not severe. Only 5 to 10% of military personnel seek specialty mental health care every year, but over 90% use primary care. The impact will be great if we improve the mental health of those getting primary care. Deployment Health Clinical Center has partnered with the MacArthur Foundation, Dartmouth, Durham VA, and Indiana University in a Fort Bragg Primary Care Quality Improvement Initiative. The goal is successful implementation of VA-DOD mental health guidelines. The program is called RespectMIL and builds on a scientifically tested approach for depression developed by Alan Dietrich at Dartmouth. Use of RespectMIL improves continuity, maximizes existing primary care resources, and frees mental health providers to practice specialty care. We look for broader implementation and evaluation in the future. Many with PTSD may benefit from psychosocial approaches offered in primary care. Our investigators have collaborated with Brett Litz of the Boston VA and the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Richard Bryant in Australia, to develop an NIH-funded computer-assisted therapy tool called De-Stress. De-Stress offers anonymity and a scientifically valid approach that primary care doctors can prescribe to patients in need. Many will obtain relief, and for others, de-stress may reduce stigma. We are also pushing information to clinicians through the Deployment Health Clinical Center's pdhealth.mil website and Uniformed Services University's Courage to Care program. pdhealth.mil gets over 700,000 hits a month. 1,300 providers receive our daily science and news email digest, and we have distributed 10,000 deployment health toolboxes to primary care providers across the services. We also run toll-free telephone and email helpline for providers, service members, and families. Providing care for the severely wounded and ill is a fulfillment of a sacred trust, the promise of every combat medic makes to assist injured comrades. Walter Reed's psychiatry consultation service, led by Hal Wayne, follows every wounded soldier. Deployment Health Clinical Center serves as a worldwide referral center for severe post-deployment illness. We have run nearly 120 cycles of two different specialized care programs, one for unexplained illness and another for PTSD. We published the unexplained illness approach in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, after a 20-site VA cooperative studies program study. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I hope I have communicated my three main points. First, we must bring safe and confidential mental health care to service members rather than waiting for them to seek it. Second, primary care is an excellent opportunity for doing just that. And third, many DOD efforts are underway to reach providers, service members, families, the severely ill, and the wounded. The Deployment Health Clinical Center and its devoted staff are privileged to assist the inspiring men and women who serve our nation. We owe our success to an unwavering support from Congress, DOD, Uniformed Services University, and the Army Medical Department. Thank you for allowing me to appear before you today. I would be pleased to respond to any questions from members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony. I now recognize Dr. Friedman.
Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, I'm Matthew Friedman. I'm the executive director of VA's National Center for PTSD, professor of psychiatry, pharmacology, and toxicology at Dartmouth Medical School. I've been a VA psychiatrist for over 30 years and spent much of that time treating men and women who have developed PTSD and other problems as a result of their service in combat areas. I've been asked to comment on the PTSD syndrome itself, and I've submitted extensive information about that in my written testimony, which I will not cover in my oral comments. I would like to emphasize, however, as has the previous speakers, that most people who return from a combat zone do not have psychiatric or psychological problems. A large number of them who do have transient problems, adjustment disorders from which they recover quite quickly. But there is a significant minority, an important minority, who will develop recurring and sometimes totally incapacitating psychiatric problems, of which PTSD is the most symptomatic. I've been asked to comment about the comparisons between the current situation and the post-Vietnam era in which I cut my teeth as a clinician, and I think that the news is good. And I want to emphasize two points in particular. First of all, when our men and women returned from Vietnam, they returned to a hostile public, a public that did not reward or recognize their courage. That's not the case today, and I think it's very important. We know that social support is a key factor in whether or not people are going to readjust successfully after their combat experiences or not, and hopefully that is a very good sign, and a very good sign, the fact that we're having these hearings today that may help our returnees from the OIF and OEF deployments. The second news is also good, and that is that there has been a great deal of scientific progress in the past 30 years. When we were first faced with the Vietnam veterans, we didn't have any evidence-based treatments. We didn't really know what to do with them. It was really a bootstrap, a seat-of-your-pants type of an operation. Now we have medications that work, two of which have FDA approval. We have psychosocial treatments that are very, very effective. Last year, there was a joint VA-DOD practice guideline process to develop state-of-the-art evidence-based treatments for PTSD, both within DOD and VA, and they are state-of-the-art. And now the VA has made an institutional commitment to support that effort through a best practices project through which PTSD will be the pilot project to disseminate this information so all VA clinicians can provide the best care for people who come into our offices. The problem is, will they come? Will the stigma that Dr. Hoag's research has indicated keep them away? Will they know, as Mrs. Pelkey did not know, what's available, what the signs of PTSD are, what kinds of services are available, should they wish to recognize a problem among a loved one or within themselves? I think that the challenge for dissemination, for information, for families, and for servicemen and for veterans is a great one and a very, very important one. Unlike our DOD colleagues, we VA clinicians do not have a mandate to provide direct services to families. I think that's a disadvantage, with the glaring exception or the wonderful exception of the vet centers that Dr. Botras will comment on. We VA clinicians can only see families as adjunctive to treatment of our veterans. I think where our mandate changed and there were appropriate resources to serve that mandate, we could do a much better job and perhaps prevent some of the problems that we hope to prevent. In addition to my concern about stigma, I'm worried about the garden reserves, and I've commented on that in two New England Journal of Medicine editorials. Will they fall into the cracks? Will they recognize what's available in the VA hospitals? Will they know about their eligibility? I don't know. I think we need to make every effort to inform them, to get the word out. Other concerns are military sexual trauma, which is even more toxic than combat trauma in terms of producing PTSD. I'm concerned about the men and women returning from these deployments who will have severe medical problems, a loss of limbs, loss of eyesight, other kinds of persistent problems. They're a very high risk for PTSD, and we need to be able to monitor and provide the best treatment that we can. We need to recognize that we have a new young cohort of people seeking our treatment with fresh trauma problems, and we need to be able to provide the best services. In short, VA has the best expertise, the most sophisticated clinicians, the best spectrum of treatment in the world. We need to make sure and cherish that what has been accomplished and have our services available so that we can help those who seek our help. My final comments, which I'll run through quickly, concern collaborations between the National Center and the DOD. You've heard about three of them. We've been working with Colonel Hoag in terms of the debriefing study that was done in Kosovo and will be repeated with OIF tropes. We're working with Dr. Engel on the web-based treatment at Walter Reed, as well as the pilot project at Fort Bragg, integrating primary care and mental health care, which I think, had it been accomplished, might have helped Mrs. Pelkey and her husband. We're doing brain imaging with troops from Fort Drum, as well as drug studies. We're doing a major pre-post-deployment study, about 17,000 troops deployed. And so I would like to close by just thanking the committee for its attention and concern, and thanking all the support that we've received from VA and DOD. Thank you.
Thank the gentleman for his testimony. Let me pause to ask Colonel Hoag, Lieutenant Colonel Engel, Dr. Friedman, Dr. Batras, Dr. King, do each of you have written testimony? And would each of the witnesses like that to be submitted for the record?
Yes, sir.
All witnesses have answered in the affirmative. Hearing no objection, will be so ordered. We'll now recognize Dr. Batras.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the opportunity to present on services provided by the program that I am privileged to head to returning veterans from Operation Enduring and Iraqi Freedom. I just wanted to add a few brief points to the comments I submitted to the committee with my written testimony. The VA program that I represent was initiated by Congress 25 years ago to address readjustment challenges in Vietnam combat veterans. Matt Friedman, to my right, was one of the field docs who actually was instrumental in putting up one of our very first vet centers at that time. The Vet Center is a first of its kind. It represents the foundation from which VA became the world leader in providing these services to war veterans. The Congress subsequently extended these services to all era combat veterans and their families. Therefore, any veteran who served in a combat zone is eligible. Not unusual to find a World War II veteran alongside with a Korean War veteran and now an Iraqi Freedom veteran at our vet centers. The heart of our program is veterans and their families. The 207 vet centers dispersed nationwide are staffed primarily by veterans, many of whom have served in a combat zone. We understand the culture of the military and the sacrifices that service members make to this country. On a personal note, I want to put into the record that my dad was a World War II veteran, as well as his five brothers. They all served in World War II. I am a Vietnam combat veteran, and I have a son who served in the Persian Gulf with the 82nd Airborne. I am typical of the employees in the Vet Center program. The Vet Center program is a VA gold standard in veteran and family satisfaction. 99% of our clients and families not only rate us highly, but they would recommend us to other veterans. We are also the gold standard in VA for employee satisfaction. We are located in easy-to-access locations within their community, and we have minimal bureaucratic barriers to accessing care. A veteran will be seen when they walk in. We have no waiting list, along with their families. The program laid the foundation for model outreach services to combat veterans in our great country, characterized by a focus on providing a safe, confidential environment where veterans who have been traumatized or have gone through experiences can come in and receive timely and friendly services. In FY03, with a few months of war under our belts, we saw about 1,900 OEF-OIF veterans. In FY04, we saw over 9,600. And for this year, we're projecting over 14,000 new OEF-OIF veterans walking through our vet centers. They currently represent about 10% of our client workload. We do not include in this count the growing number of veterans and their families to whom we provide education, debriefing, and outreach services to DMOPE sites and National Guard and Reserve locations all over this country. In order to get a better handle on that, we just did a survey for the month of June in this FY in which we documented 5,000 servicemen and women in that particular month who received services in that category. Included in that are family members of National Guard and Reserve folks who have deployed but are currently not eligible for VA services because their family member is an active military member. We are reaching a fair amount of these veterans, but I have to honestly say that we have a lot of work to do in making sure that we are providing comprehensive nets to all these veterans. The Secretary of VA and my bosses, Dr. Cussman and Perlin, authorized the hiring of 50 veterans from Operation Enduring Freedom and Iraqi Freedom to become outreach workers for my program approximately a year ago. Again, these are recently returned combat veterans, many of them disabled, who have recently returned from their tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. The initial 50 program proved so successful that the Undersecretary has authorized an additional 50 FDEE or positions for this year. These veteran employees continue the program emphasis, our program emphasis on hiring veterans into the VA. As you have read in my written testimony, we have initiated a bereavement program for family members of those who died while on active duty. In coordination and referral from DOD casualty assistance officers, we have provided services to well over 400 families in the last year and a half, the majority, over 300 of them, coming from KIAs in Iraq. Our standard is to offer services directly to the family within 2 days of notification in the community in which they reside. We will be conducting an analysis of our year and a half worth of work with DOD to see if we can improve on our services and get feedback from our consumers about how we can move to improve these types of services. We are very cost-effective and outcome-driven. As a rough benchmark, the VA reported OEF-OIF veterans who have been seen for comparable mental health services within the VA. Our numbers are about 50% of those that have been seen. It's not including the ones we provide outreach services to. The vet centers continue to provide a unique service that is integrated with traditional mental health services and adds value to serving veterans and their families. They want to confuse what we do with what the VA medical centers do. We only provide one component of the services, primarily focused on outreach, assessment, and treatment of veterans who are closer to home and may not require the extensive services that VA offers. The DOD concepts of having mental health services available to soldiers while in the combat area represent a major advancement in dealing with the social and psychological sequelae of combat service. The study by Colonel Hogue and the work done by Colonel Engel, are very instrumental in providing a continuum of care for the soldiers. The soldiers are going to face a transition where when you blink, you go from a very supportive community environment back into civilian life. And I think they need all the assistance that we can provide to them to make that that step into civilian life, and to keep them healthy and connected, and quite frankly, to provide a varied assortment of services, to include employment issues, benefit kinds of things that is critical not only to the soldier but to their family in an integrated fashion. Yesterday, I heard a presentation by the Surgeon General of the Navy, I believe Vice Admiral Arnold, who described their Marine Corps Oscar teams and how they operate. Along with the Army combat stress teams, I think the Marine Corps has done an exceptional job, both of them have, in developing these types of interventions within the combat zone. The Oscar teams are embedded in their unit and are not a separate component or medical unit, therefore promoting an integration into the Marine Corps unit for functioning. This is an exact model of how vet centers operate. We are embedded in your local communities and geographically located outside of VA medical centers. This goes a long way to avoid the stigma of accessing care and promotes the normalization of issues that will arise in most of our veterans, that being the recognition that serving in a combat zone presents challenges to any soldier, and that the integration of these types of services, as has been indicated before, is really critical. Thank you.
Dr. Batras, on behalf of this committee, let me extend an appreciation to your family from the service to country, not only including your uncles and your father, but yourself and your son.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Keene, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the members of the committee for permitting me to testify here today with my distinguished colleagues. Today I am representing the Association of VA Psychologist Leaders, and while I've spent some 28 years in the Department of Veterans Affairs in three different VA medical centers as chief of psychology, my comments today represent that group of VA psychology leaders. VA represents the best in mental health systems in the world. This has been touted in both the New England Journal of Medicine as well as in The Lancet in the past 2 years. With expertise in post-traumatic stress disorder, schizophrenia, the neurosciences, geropsychiatry, and substance abuse, we address the full range and spectrum of combat-related psychological problems. With reference to today's hearings, I do want to say that as a professor and faculty member at Boston University, one of the largest healthcare systems in the city of Boston, there is not a single expert in the area of post-traumatic stress disorder on faculty, not one. It would seem hard for me to fathom how private sector resources could be marshaled to provide the kinds of care that's provided by VA in the Vet Center program and in the many different installations across the country. I do want to comment for a moment about the VA's leadership role in the President's New Freedom Commission. The VA has established an outstanding action agenda. And with the current administration, there is tremendous support for moving forward and implementing many of the ideas represented and creatively developed by the VA mental health care employees. There are many examples of VA's tremendous support for the returning OEF and OIF veterans. But there are also some important issues for us to discuss here today. Our group, and that is the AVIPAL, VA Psychologist Leaders, fully supports the notion of a fully resourced President's New Freedom Commission agenda. These resources should be implemented, they should be evaluated, they should be monitored. And the question remains for us is how will these resources, in a system that is strained for resources, how will these resources be protected to ensure that they deliver the kind of care that is intended? With the growing numbers of mental health needs, we also, in VA, need to employ the most contemporary, the most creative methods of delivery of services. This will require that our aging workforce be retooled and retrained with a major educational initiative. In what directions should this take? There should be training in the use of telehealth, already one of Dr. Perlin's major initiatives. This should be directed in the area of mental health so that services can be provided. As well, web-based interventions should be prioritized so that patients can get needed education and needed support when and where they need it. We have information that the availability of internet is quite strong among younger generations, and we should make use of this resource for the delivery of whatever services are viable in that modality. As well, continued collaborations with the Department of Defense in integrating care and conducting research on these newest veterans needs to continue to be the highest priority. Our organization also supports, as many of my colleagues have already stated, the changes in eligibility that have already been made, and would like to see increased eligibility, again, for families, for spouses, for partners affected by activation, deployment, injury, or death. As well, we support the completion of the National Vietnam Veterans Longitudinal Study. We support the completion of this study, not only for what it will tell us about Vietnam veterans, the largest cohort of veterans that exists in VA today, but as well what it will tell us about the current group of the newest veterans. Our group also supports an increase in the research budget that's allocated to study mental health and behavioral health problems. It is indeed the case that the behavioral science, the mental health research workforce, is graying in VA. There needs to be a concerted effort to support junior people to study the problems associated with military service and combat trauma. But as well, and perhaps most importantly, from my perspective, behavioral health services, psychiatric and psychological, need to be paired with physical rehabilitation in order to maximize and optimize the outcome. VA is one of the world's leaders in the area of physical rehabilitation. We suggest that combining mental health services at significant levels with the outstanding physical rehabilitation will yield the best possible outcomes for the people who are so injured. There are many other recommendations reflected in my written report. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you all for the opportunity to speak with you here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I would like to exercise a cautionary counsel to my colleagues with regard to Ms. Pilkey's testimony from the first panel. Only she has the right to privacy, and that she waived the right to privacy with regard to her comments regarding her husband's case. We now know that she has an interest in filing an appeal with the Surgeon General of the Army. So I would exercise caution, and I think it would be inappropriate to ask any of the experts on any of the this panel or the next panel to comment directly upon her husband's case. But obviously, process and procedures are open. And that would be my counsel to my colleagues. The where do new doctors turn to in the private sector and in military settings to gain awareness and then develop an expertise with regard to how to deal with PTSD? Because it's not just those who serve in the military. You're also dealing with police officers after gun battles. You're dealing with firefighters, the first responders in our society. We have teams that will arrive upon the scenes of tornadoes, hurricanes, traumatic events. So how are we doing as a country, and where is this really being generated? I'll just open it up. Anybody would like to comment?
I'll begin. I'm sure there'll be others who will speak. It is a major initiative of ours at the National Center for PTSD to try to influence the education and training programs in both psychiatry residency training programs as well as in psychology, clinical psychology training programs. We have engaged in this initiative for the full 16 years that we've been involved in this work. We've been supported by the National Institute of Mental Health in providing education and training at the most advanced levels for some 12 years now. And it's through these mechanisms that we have actually conducted, I think, significant education and training, both in our own institutions, but as well in a variety of different places across the country. It is solving a problem, given that PTSD is really only widely recognized since 1980. It's been solving a problem for this country that has taken some of our time. How do you create and generate a whole cadre, a whole cohort of people who can take care of people who have been sexually assaulted or the other kinds of events that you've mentioned? It has not been easy to do this. There are not experts at every medical school in the country. There are not experts at every clinical psychology training program in the country in these areas. Yet it's actually a vastly improved situation today than it was when I entered the field 28 years ago.
Dr. Friedman?
I appreciate your question, Mr. Chairman. I think that you're right on target, that although PTSD treatment research began in VA, I think that we have really been a major force in influencing the civilian sector in many, many different ways. In addition to our graduates and people who benefited from our programs and people who've come into VA and gone on to influence training programs in psychiatry, psychology, social work, and nursing throughout the United States and certainly in the developed nations as well, there has been recognition that sexual trauma, that disaster trauma, the recent tsunami to be a one of many examples, a call for the kind of expertise that was first developed in PTSD. One of the things that the National Center and the field in general has done has moved from the VA as the spawning ground and taken the same technologies, the same conceptual tools, the same clinical tools, and used them with women who've been sexually traumatized, with disaster victims. The National Center has had a 5-year collaboration with SAMHSA, with the disaster research branch of SAMHSA, rather the emergency disaster branch, and we were major players in the post 9/11 recovery. In terms of what's happened institutionally within the field in general, there have been independent efforts with a lot of overlap and collaboration with VA practitioners to develop evidence-based practice guidelines from other organizations. The International Society for Traumatic Stress Studies, which Dr. Keene and I are both past presidents, actually developed the first practice guideline for PTSD, which was published in 2000. Since then, there have been two other practice guidelines. One was the American Psychiatric Association practice guideline, which came out last year, and the joint VA-DOD practice guideline, which I mentioned in my testimony. So perhaps that's responsive to your question.
With regard to the seamless transition, medical records, DOD to VA, VA back to DOD, are these occurring electronically, or is it paper? What's happening out there right now? Does anybody know?
Most of the handoffs are by paper and by phone, and it actually, at least by my report, in my experience, it's actually working very well in many, many, many instances. So we're very pleased about how this integration has occurred. I think you were
asking
about
the post-deployment health surveys. Do you get those? The VA getting those?
No.
Great. You know, we put a lot of effort into this. I wrote the law for a reason. for you to do these pre-deployments and post-deployments and then to make sure they get to the VA. So if DOD doesn't care about them getting to the VA, are they getting there? Let me turn to the DOD. Tell me what's happening.
If I may, there are a number of challenges in the data sharing area, not the least of which is are the HIPAA laws.
No, you can't pull HIPAA on me.
Well, I'm sorry.
You can't pull HIPAA because you got it. You can't do that. Because we Congress say you can move that data. So go to the next comment. Can't pull HIPAA on us.
Sir, I'm really not trying to pull.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, yes, don't. Just erase HIPAA.
Yeah.
Now go to the next.
The level at which I operate, these are challenges that we
HIPAA is a challenge, but it's not a challenge with regard to the sharing of information and how we get it from DOD to VA. That's the only point I wanted to make.
I mean, I think we've made enormous strides in taking the post-deployment health assessment data. It's all in a data repository where it can be analyzed in near real time. I think that we as an organization would welcome the opportunity to share that data with the VA and do so rapidly.
All right. Mr. Filner?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, I wish you were not always so defensive about anything that comes from this side of the aisle, but if I were you, I would walk Mrs. Pelkey over to the department, to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, and have her talk to them. And maybe we can help her do that. What amazes me, gentlemen, when I hear people from various bureaucracies talking and are doing their studies and working hard, it's almost as if you're working in this vacuum outside the real world. You all just heard an incredibly emotional and moving testimony by Mrs. Pelkey. I didn't hear one statement reacting to that. I didn't hear any passion about, oh, we're going to correct that and here's what we need. You read your little statements that you did before. You make incredible statements like, Colonel Hogue, you said, we have a distinctly proactive approach. That's demonstrably false, at least in terms of the vast majority of our soldiers. We don't have a proactive approach, and I don't know how you can even say that. Everybody there is Pollyanna. We had maybe one suggestion for change. I thought we would hear from you after listening to the testimony. What do we have to do, and how much money do you need to do it? It seems to me that that's what you ought to be reacting to on a human scale and not on your bureaucratic studies. I have a PhD. I understand research. But, Mr. Colonel Hogue, I could have told you everything you said about, I don't know how much that study cost. Mrs. Pelkey could have told you all that just by sitting down with an interview and telling her experiences. And a lot of spouses could have done the same thing. I hope you're going more than a year out, but that's all you talked about. When we know these symptoms occur later on, and even within the context of your own study, of your own testimony, which is so Pollyannish, I don't understand how you can not sit there and be angry about what we are doing as a nation to meet these needs. I think Colonel Hogue or Colonel Engel said your center had seen 1,500 post Iraq. Servicemen, 1,500 out of the tens of thousands. You said in your own testimony there are 700,000 hits a month on your website. That means that's an incredible number of people of interest in what we are doing, and we're meeting only a few. Your 1 in 4 statement after 12 months, I think, is I don't understand why you would even stick to that when we know these things, one, come up after 12 months, but second, how difficult it is for people to admit this kind of situation or to even get a lot of data on it, as we have heard so movingly in the testimony. Captain Pelkey wouldn't have even been in one of your statistics, and yet there he was, very sick, very ill. I appreciate Dr. Friedman saying, the only suggestion I really heard from you guys is that You don't have a mandate in the VA to deal with families as opposed to the individual veterans. That's an important statement, and we ought to remedy that. And I appreciate you saying that. But we could have heard 25 things probably from you all who are experts to tell us what we had to do, and all I hear is we're doing everything right. Statement that the Vet Center had gone up from a few thousand to 14,000 in last year, that shows what you're trying to do and the need. I don't know. I don't think there's been a great increase in number of staff there to serve this incredible increase. You need to say, hey, we went from 3,000 to 14,000 and our staff went up, you know, a few people to deal with that. That's what we have to know. What do we have to do to meet the needs? And all I hear is that everything is fine. Everything is not fine. We have suicides. We have divorces. We have domestic violence. We have crime. We have homelessness. Let's get passionate about that stuff. The fact that a veteran is not being helped and commits suicide or is on the street should get everybody there angry as an American citizen about this issue. We know how to treat this stuff. We know how to do it. We've advanced that far, and yet we're not getting the services that you need. So I'm very disappointed by all your testimony. I mean, you guys are locked in these studies and your journals. Go out and talk to these folks, and you get all the information you need. And I just want to know, how much money does it cost to do the kind of work that Mrs. Pelkey laid out? We know we have to deal with the families. We know we have to spread the information to all the service providers. We know we have to deal. We have to have peer discussions. Just tell me how much that's going to cost, and let's do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sir, if I may,
sure. Go ahead. Respond.
Respond to that. I think that the critical, if I understand your question, sir, the critical element is, given the research which shows that there is a significant risk of mental health problems, particularly PTSD, are the resources sufficient to take care of our service members coming back?
That was a great translation of my emotion into bureaucratic language, but go ahead. I mean, I don't know why you have to talk that way. Talk as human being and not, you know, the study based on, and we have to get the resources conditioned on. I mean, come on, guys. These are people who are suffering. I want to know, how much money do we need to make sure they stop suffering? Just okay. That's all you have to do.
I think he understands this. Let him respond.
I would just like to add, if I can, that there are approximately 10 very specific recommendations in my written testimony that I think warrant consideration by the group, and I'd be happy to elaborate on them if given the opportunity.
Since I'm sitting in for the chairman and he's not yet returned, I'm interested in some of the comments of my colleague. In the last couple of years, there have been, as staff was just pointing out, the chief of staff here, that there have been about 100 people added to take care of the need. Is that sufficient? What's that? In the vet centers.
We just got an additional 50. The original 50.
Yeah, I understand that. He just told me that, too. But if what my colleagues said is correct, there was 15,000 last year. Is that what you said?
He said 14,000.
14,000. Is 100 new people in the last couple of years sufficient to deal with that problem? And I'd also like for you to elaborate a little bit more on what he was asking about the families. Is there a mechanism for these families to get the kind of assistance that they need as well? You know, I know some people that were in Vietnam. And when they came back, there was a great deal of stress upon them, but also on their families, because the adjustment to these people was really substantial. You know, one, they have a loved one that goes, it's a pretty warm, fuzzy guy, and when he comes back, he's a hardened veteran who's seen some of the worst atrocities and tragedies that you can imagine, and the family has to adjust. Is there any provision as well for the family members? And if not, should there be?
A point of clarification, and I don't think you were here when it was said. My program...
Well, I apologize for that. Go ahead.
...does have eligibility for family members. So we see family members, we see the significant others and the children. In our bereavement program, the whole aim is to treat the whole family because DOD only treats one individual, usually the significant other. We've expanded our services to the entire family of operation, and we've been doing that for a while. The other thing is that you're exactly right. We became very proactive early on to get those 50 FDW authorized so we can begin to do the outreach mechanisms. Before this operation, we had no experience with the number of National Guard and Reserve folks that are being activated, and some of them doing their second and third tours right now. So in anticipation for that, we designated those folks, and we hired from within the returning soldiers to do the outreach and to provide access to care for the VA. And they're bringing in a significant number. I suspect that the next 50 will also be equally as effective in doing that. I think we need to assess and see if 100 is enough. And if it's not, I think we should get more, or I would certainly advocate for more resources through my particular avenue. I do want to dispel the perception that we're not passionate. I'm a disabled Vietnam combat veteran, and I take my job seriously, mm-hmm. as I think most VA folks do. And we are working very proactively to do what we can for our fellow veterans, and I think that I would extend that to a good number of our folks in our program. The problem is, from my perspective, that you know, figuring out what would be appropriate for the increasing numbers when you don't know what they're going to be initially, and then as you go along developing those and then quickly staff them. I feel very fortunate to have the additional 100 FDW, and I'll guarantee you they're being put to very good use.
I'd like to comment also in sure. response to some of the earlier statements. It's a new ball game. I think that looking and trying to project resources based on traditional accounts of people that come through the turnstiles to VA clinics or vet center clinics is only a piece of it. As Mrs. Pelkey indicated, and as some of us indicated in our testimony, there are new initiatives, new kinds of things that we really are just beginning to get our heads around. The collaboration between the VA and the DOD is unprecedented in my experience. It's very, very welcome, the fact that I'm doing a number of projects with these two gentlemen as well as many other people in uniform is something that hasn't happened until very, very recently. It's not, and much of the effort, I think, has to be about prevention, about education, as Dr. Keene said, using web-based technologies. We've developed, and I gave four copies to the committee in conjunction with Walter Reed Army Medical Center, a Iraq War clinician guide, which is a state-of-the-art manual on how to treat these people. It's available on the web. It's available by CD-ROM. Prevention, outreach to families. Costing that out, I think, is something that we're really unfamiliar with, and I think we need to do it because it's a major part of what has to be done.
Well, you have a Vietnam veteran sitting there next to you, and the experience in Vietnam and Korea and the other conflicts with which we've been involved, it strikes me as unusual that you're saying you don't have the experience to deal with some of these problems. I mean, we've had war after war after war in our history, and each one of those wars gave information to the various agencies on how to deal with these stressful problems that are created. I mean, you know, they had horrible things in World War I and II, trench warfare in Korea and Vietnam. And from what I'm gathering from you folks is that you're experiencing something new, because maybe the National Guard's involved. There's still military personnel who's involved in combat, and it seems to me that the statistical data that you've had from previous conflicts could be a real benefit. And I just don't understand why, you know, you seem, I don't know, somewhat bewildered, because this is something new. I don't think it is anything new, is it?
May I clarify?
Sure. I mean, I'd like to know. I mean, I'm... You better turn your mic on.
I thought I covered some of that in my testimony.
Well, I apologize. I wasn't here.
What's certainly not new are developing evidence-based treatments. And as I said, we didn't have the kind of treatments 30 years ago for the Vietnam vets that we have now. And we've learned a great deal from Vietnam. What is new is the immediacy, the collaboration with the DOD. It was 10, 15, 20 years after people returned from Vietnam, before VA had the capacity, the eligibility, and people were coming into VA. What's new now is the fact that there are families out there with returnees who've just come in a day or two ago. That's new. It's new for VA, and it's an important opportunity. It's an opportunity that we welcome. So it's not about being bewildered. It's about being recognizing the problem, identifying it, and trying to be as proactive as possible.
Well, how long will it take before you know how many additional personnel you're going to need to deal with this large number of people who need attention and care? I mean, I think you said 14,000. Is that correct? 14,000?
I think it's very hard to make projections. I'll defer to Dr. Hoag. I mean, it's very early in the game. The data we have on Vietnam veterans, we obtained in the mid-'80s.
Based upon the data you had back then, how long would it take to take care of 14,000 people and give them the attention they need? And how much would you need additional personnel for that?
I give up.
So, sir, I think there's ample data available for us to project service utilization needs and resource needs, and I would like to take the question for the record and get back to you on specifics of exactly what resources we would like to request to best serve our service members.
So what you're saying is, from the experience you've had in the past, Colonel, that you could project fairly accurately the need.
Yes, sir.
Why hasn't that been done before now? I'm just curious. I mean.
Well, I think that the combined data of what we...
I mean, the war's been going on there for 2 years, over 2 years,
yeah.
And we also had Desert Storm before that. Why hasn't there been some statistical data showing what the need would be before now?
Well, virtually every study that was conducted in prior wars, sir, were done literally years, sometimes decades, after service members came home. This is the first war where we're actually collecting data in real time and calculating rates. But we now have 2 years' worth of data, and I think that's sufficient to make reasonable, you know, maybe not the most accurate, but I think reasonable projections.
How long would it take for us to get that here on the committee? I know the chairman and others would like to have that.
Well, I'm a researcher, and I will do my very best to go to my leadership and get that answer for you as quickly as possible, sir.
You can't give us any time frame, month, 2 months, 2 weeks?
I don't see any reason why it can't be done in the next month or so. I mean, I can't speak for my leadership, but it's something which we have been wrestling with. What are the resource needs, for instance, with the upcoming post-deployment reassessment that's going to be done at 3 to 6 months. That reassessment is going to generate a large number of soldiers coming in for care, and there's a lot of serious questions being asked about what are the resources that are necessary to provide the services for those service members that are identified.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Well, let me just say, because I know the chairman's going to be back here in a minute, I would personally, as a member of the committee and one who's been on and off this committee for about 20-some years, I'd like to have not only the statistical data on how many people you would need to take care of those who are coming back, but also if you could project out how many people you would need based upon past experience to deal with some of the family members that are suffering from the results of the stress caused by the conflict on these soldiers. So if we could, and you don't have to be precise, I don't think anybody expects you to be, you know, precise, but we'd like to know what the need is. Congress can't appropriate or authorize the resources necessary to take care of a problem unless we've got some pretty good data.
Yeah.
And if people are vague about that, you know, we go to the authorizing committee and they say, well, how much do you need and why, and nobody has an answer, then they can't authorize, and the appropriators are very difficult to deal with if you can't give them some pretty clean-cut information. So if you could get that for us in the next, you said you think maybe within a month you could get it, that'd be great.
I work with the leadership at the Surgeon General's office and DOD to try to get those more specific estimates of resource needs to the committee. Sir.
But so, for the record, you think you can get that within a month, maybe?
I shouldn't.
Will you try to get it within?
I will do the best I can to nudge the system along to do that. Yes.
Okay. Sir. Thank you, Colonel, very much. I see the chairman's back. I'll turn the chair back over to him.
Udall.
Mr. Udall, you're now recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you all for your testimony here today. Many of the veterans that return come from rural areas, and I don't, at least from my own experience in my congressional district in my state, it seems like they're disproportionately from rural areas. And I was wondering, in terms of the services that each of you have talked about and what's being provided now, do we have the capability to deal with veterans that are 200 and 300 and 400 miles from the large hospitals? Are rural veterans treated differently because they live so far from those facilities? I mean, what is being done to deal with that kind of situation? And any of the members of the panel that can speak to
Sir,
that.
If I may, I would like to say that Captain Pelkey's terrible story is for me a sober reminder of the overwhelming charge that we have to care for our own. At the Deployment Health Clinical Center, what we are doing with the Respect Mill study, and as Dr. Friedman mentioned, we're collaborating with the National Center on this and exploring ways to go broader within within DOD. This is a potential, has the potential to maximize services for people who are in outlying places, people who are otherwise maybe falling through the cracks. So I think that, again, the opportunity to afford good mental health care through primary care is a way of reaching out to rural communities. And if we can bolster continuity in primary care, people will not fall through the cracks, and we won't experience the sorts of terrible tragedies that we've heard about today.
And do you think they're getting the training they need out in these primary care facilities to recognize PTSD? And
so one of the in the Respect Mill effort that we have developed a primary care education module for primary care docs that speak to them at their level of understanding of post-traumatic stress disorder and facilitate care and improve the structure of primary care by allowing them to use good screening tools and tools that measure the severity of patients' illness. It's not just a knowledge issue. There are also important structural changes that have to take place in the clinic so that patients who struggle with these sorts of challenges get the intensive time and attention that they need. I would also add, too, that Uniformed Services University's Department of Psychiatry and its Center for the Study of Traumatic Stress is a leader in creating educational materials through its Courage to Care program for communities that are dealing with disaster, war, terrorism. NRPDHealth.mil website has extensive information about the clinical practice guidelines for post-traumatic stress disorder, for depression, and other mental health conditions. And we make specific efforts to design that site so that primary care clinicians can access them quickly.
As a mental health practitioner who has worked in a rural area all of his professional life, I think I thank you for your question. I think that the challenges of any health delivery, especially mental health delivery in rural areas, are very unique and very important. And I think that within VA there are a number of options. Certainly the Vet Center program is one of them, and Dr. Batras can describe that. There are also community-based outreach clinics, where outpatient clinics where VA practitioner and VA clinics are set up in places at a distance from the flagship hospital, so that the transportation and road condition problems that often are barriers to access in rural areas can be overcome. There are also partnerships with community mental health centers that have been done in certain areas. In addition to the, this is kind of traditional stuff, but I think that given the information age, the internet, the telehealth capability, this is really, and this is what I, one of the things I've been trying to address in some of my answers and my initial comments, is this is a very good way to reach rural practitioners. The National Center's website, we're getting 65,000 unique users a month, is one way that people can access the latest on treatments and download it no matter where they are. We've even been able to do this with people providing help in the tsunami-stricken areas. We have we're working on a state-of-the-art a curriculum. We call it PTSD 101, which will be a web-based production. In partnership with Uniform Services, University of Health Sciences, we've proposed a very, very ambitious and extensive educational initiative, which will be using telehealth and web-based technologies as well as face-to-face to upgrade the skills of DOD and VA practitioners. So I think that there are many, many options that we have available, and we need to make good use of them.
Any other comments from the panel? Or?
Briefly, just say a few things. One of the ways that we extend our services is our contract for fees program within the Vet Center program, where we contract with private providers in rural areas. Although limited, we found that that particular program is very effective if we can find the providers with the skills and the training to provide these services. We've also established outreach centers that are what we call outstations. For example, we have 5 vet centers on Native American land. These are very rural areas where places like Hopi and Navajo and other reservations, we've gone out and established an outstation in that particular reservation to provide services closer to their communities. So, for example, if you're in Hopi or Navajo, as you well know, you have to drive a long way to get to Phoenix or to Albuquerque. So we promote services that are local and attempt to do that. The other thing that we're doing, especially with the National Guard and Reserve, is working very closely with General Blum and the National Guard Registry, as well as the reservists. We are establishing, and I think the National Guard will be rolling out a plan that is state-based, where we're creating coalitions of all community resources and coordinating the services. And I think that will help to improve our services to rural areas. But I want to also say what Matt said, and that is a challenge when veterans are dispersed over a great geographical area and getting the appropriate services to them. But those are some of the things that we've enacted.
Ms. Napolitano.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for
I'm sorry.
Are you finished?
Are you finished? Did you have a follow-up question?
Well, no, I didn't have a follow-up. My time was out, but I noticed Dr. Keene.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. Proceed if you have a – sure, that's fine. That's fine. Thank you.
I just want to concur that these are complicated matters when you have a centralized system, but the CBOCs, the community-based outpatient clinics, is one important answer, as are the many programs that Dr. Batres has put into place. The issue with CBOCs, however, is the extent to which there is specialized care, and among the concerns that many of us have is that primary care doctors are already extraordinarily busy and very hardworking, and to take on the burden of both diagnosing and treating combat-related problems becomes a burden that may just be too much for them to bear. The question, of course, is at what point can we have and how can we have mental health services in these clinics? And this is being actively debated and discussed and in many places implemented, but I think we could likely do more there.
Thank you very much.
If I might follow up before we yield to Ms. Napolitano, Could it not be included in the information that I requested earlier, some kind of an analysis on how much revenue would have to be requested from the government to take care of the need for these people in the rural areas who need psychiatric help? If you could give us that. You know, like I said before, I think one of the problems with this committee and every committee in Congress, I was chairman of Government Reform Committee for 6 years, is that we don't get enough information from the various bureaucracies to be able to ascertain how much money we need to spend and how many people are going to be needed to take care of the job. to do the job. So if you could try to get that along with Colonel Hoge. Hoge, is it?
Yes, sir.
Colonel Hoge, we'd really appreciate it. I mean, he's already said he could get all this done in about 2 weeks. Or did you say 4 weeks?
Sir, anyhow. I said I go to my leadership and pass on your request for...
Well, we'll call your leadership and tell them you made a hard commitment for a week. How's that? As quick as you can get it done. I'm sorry. Does that answer your question? Ms. Napolitano?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've listened with great interest because PTSD has been something that I've been very interested in, very involved in since my days in State Assembly in California. Some of the questions and one of the answers that Dr. Batras gave in regard to the treatment, I believe you said it was bereavement only. What happens with treatment to the families or assistance to the families and those that are not lost a member, because that is important. It isn't just those that have lost a loved one, but it is the family whose member has gone through these atrocities, who has been injured, not necessarily dead, and cannot deal with it because they don't know how. So does that include also services to the families?
We would cover that. Any problem that's related to their military service, we would cover. So it's not limited to just bereavement.
So the resource needs would be for the service individual and the family?
Correct.
Is the family aware of these services? Is it something that is given to them, talked about, sent to them, mailed to them, emailed? How do you get that information to them?
Well, we get the information out through the typical formats. It's in our website. We inform folks. When we do our debriefings at the DMOB sites and wherever we interact with the military, we pass out that information to them, that they are eligible. And they've been eligible for 25 years. It's not a new eligibility. We've always included the families as part of our treatment.
Okay, but that still, it does not, many families don't have access to computers, so they can't access a website. Is it possible then that you might include in writing when the VA sends information to a veteran to remind them that these services are available, that their families may seek help in instances where there is an issue of PTSD that may not recognize it's PTSD? I'm trying to figure out a way to be able to get information to the family itself as to how they can help it. They may not recognize, they may not know what PTSD is. Also, you indicated that you have a website. Can you share the website so members of Congress, I'd love to have on my website ability to link some of my veterans organizations and say, go, because I'm being asked now, who do we send these at? You know, we're starting to get these youngsters coming in and asking for help at the local VFW and American Legion. How do we tell them, here is a place for you to go or refer them to? I'm sure somebody at the VFW has access to a computer, but assistance to them at that level. Because you can't do it all, but how do we know what you're doing and how we can lend a hand in that?
Our web address is in my testimony. The National Center has sent its annual report to this committee every year. We have a section devoted to the web with the web address telling you all the bells and whistles and stuff. So if you'd like more information, I would be delighted to tell you about our website.
I'm sorry, I don't have your testimony. Maybe I missed it because I'm not a member of the committee. I happen to pick up stuff from outside, but I will look for it. Any other website that you gentlemen might have?
If I may, our website is pdhealth.mil, M-I-L. The other comment that I would make, ma'am, is that if you have a constituent, friend, or otherwise that needs assistance, I would be glad to bring the full resources of my center to assist. We are taking care of patients directly at my center. Certainly the numbers that we take care of are nowhere near the total number of people who are injured, but we come face-to-face with these folks every day. And we're trying to develop innovative programs. And I assure you, if you refer anyone to me and my center, we will take good care of them.
Thank you for the offer, and I will take you up on it if I need it and my staff needs it. But, Mr. Chair, may I ask that you include in your request for information from Colonel Hoge how best to get information out to families on PTSD that might take some doing, whether it's advertisement. We've done it for the recruitment of personnel for the armed forces. Why can't we not start making some kind of inroads in indicating that there is help for those individuals who may be, and the families for that matter, who may need help, services that you can provide. Again, this will take money, and this is something that maybe this committee might be interested in working with you. Going to primary care. Primary care is the TRICARE, I'm assuming?
Ma'am, primary care is a treatment setting before specialty care. There's primary care within TRICARE. There's primary care within the VA, and there's primary care within the Department of Defense.
My concern has been because in my area I had one clinic for my veterans, and I have a high percentage of veterans in my area. They were going to close it down. This was about 6 years ago. We have had a new clinic open, but it's outsourced. And I'm being told by the physicians that they cannot give certain services because they're not reimbursed for them. And that creates a problem for me because if veterans are going in indicating that they have PTSD and they're required to, prove that it happened during a wartime, whether it was Vietnam, whether it was a prior war, and these individuals are having problems, and I'm just telling you what problems I faced in my area. So I'm concerned about how can we get veterans who might not be identified as possible PTSD, that they can then go to an individual, whether it's private service or VA, and say to them, we need some mental health services. And I'm sorry, but this macho thing prevents a lot of my veterans from admitting that they do have a problem. And unfortunately, we just need to be able to destigmatize so that it is something that they know they can be treated for and get help for. Question.
The primary care initiative is a really important one from a number of perspectives. And I think that in the case of Mrs. Pelkey's husband, where he did see a primary care practitioner, I think that just to take that particular example, not knowing any of the other details, one of the goals, and Dr. Engel has been in front on that, Dr. Gerald Cross, head of VA's primary care, has been very, very supportive in this regard, recognizing that because of stigma, other issues, associated medical problems, veterans, guardsmen, et cetera, with PTSD, unrecognized, as is often the case, their first clinical port of call will be the primary care clinic. And that's the reason why we're so committed to trying to develop integrated primary behavioral health models of care, which have been shown to be successful with depression. A project that we're doing in collaboration with Dr. Engel at Fort Bragg is testing this model. Dr. Cross has been very enthusiastic and supportive about this. Indeed, every veteran who comes to a primary care clinic will receive a PTSD screen annually.
But what if they don't go to the primary care on PTSD? What if they just go for an issue? Can that primary care provider be able to identify that there is an issue with mental health?
That's the point of the screening. That's exactly the point of the
but
screening.
Are they trained? That's my point.
Initiative that is underway.
Yeah, well, that's why we're asking for the funding to be able to add additional trained personnel so that we can then say we have enough people to address what we perceive as a growing issue.
And as part of this program that Dr. Friedman is speaking to that we're piloting at Fort Bragg, there is an education package for the primary care doctor. And there is a sort of clinic design that's put in place. It's called a prepared practice for recognizing people. The dissemination of that is something that we look forward to the opportunity to do.
So it's still in progress. One more follow-up,
I'm very patient.
Thank you so much. Very quickly. Well, go ahead. Never mind. It's gone.
Go ahead. Make it
it's
quick.
Gone. You right. One ear, not the other.
I thank you. We have votes coming up, and we have another panel. That was the only reason, ma'am. The last thing, Dr. Ho, we really haven't really talked about your study.
and you put a lot of time into this. And I know Mr. Burton asked a question about data and having them getting that information to the committee. In order for that to even occur, how predictive are the results of your study?
I think the results of our study are predictive, and we have additional analyses that we've conducted, such as looking at how many service members have come back from OIF, have accessed services, what percent have seen mental health, what are the reasons that they've accessed services. And so we can predict with some degree of accuracy what percentage of our service members are in need of services, mental health services. And then obviously the second question to that is, are the resources adequate? And that's something I just can't, you know, comment directly on in my position.
Is that data being shared with the VA?
Excuse me?
Is it being shared with the VA?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. All of our data. That's one of our primary missions, is to get the information out in a timely manner so that it can influence policy directly.
Well, we recognize that the President's budget increased $100 million in the VA on mental health. Dr. Friedman, I want to thank you for the team that you sent to New York City immediately after September 11th on behalf of the country. Your response to that and help is noted. I'd like to thank this panel. You have invested a great deal of your life into these studies and being able to help our soldiers and the families. We know we've got them in the military, but we don't stop and pause and say, well, why? You know, we train them to kill and break things, when you think about it. And there are some mental consequences from warriors doing such things. And we train them to be rough and tough, but they are also someone's cuddly son, right? Cuddly spouse. And they do have a warm, compassionate side to that warrior spirit. And when that veil gets pierced, there are real consequences, and that's where you as professionals step in. At some point in time, though, through PTSD in a diagnosis, through treatment, they can get better, can they not?
Yes, sir.
It is a curious matter with regard to the escalation of 100% PTSD and how people they get worse, and all of a sudden when they get a 100% disability rating, then they get better. So I think what we're going to have to do is when we come back, we may have to do a secondary hearing with regard to the IG report, because it's pretty alarming with what's happening out there. Because we don't want to, we want to make sure that the precious resources we have, that the care and attention go to individuals that need it, and not to individuals who are perhaps using some form of an excuse for bad conduct or bad behavior. It's a delicate matter and delicate issues, but it's one that we have to confront. And I know that you were able to sit here and listen to the testimony from the first panel witness, and I'm glad you were here. I'm glad you could hear that. There are reasons we call certain circumstances a tragedy. And we label them as tragedy because when you go back and you do an analysis of it, there's failures all around. And this member of the Army family didn't get the support that he needed. And every port of entry for access, the referral wasn't there. It did, you know what I mean? It just... That's why we call it a tragedy. And so I imagine there are perhaps some other cases out there, but I appreciate you leaning forward. And this panel is now excused. The third panel. If you'll please come forward. Michael E. Kilpatrick, MD, is Deputy Director of the Deployment Health Support of the Office of Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, 4th Health Protection and Readiness. Dr. Kilpatrick is responsible for providing assistance to Gulf War veterans and facilitating the operational support for force health protection initiatives and the coordination of health-related deployment issues between the Office of Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs and the military departments. We'll also hear from Brigadier General Michael J. Cussman, MD, MACP, is U.S. Army retired, was appointed Deputy Undersecretary for Health for Veterans Health Administration, VHA, of the Department of Veterans Affairs on May 29, 2005, and in this capacity, he leads the clinical policy and programs for the nation's largest integrated health system. If both of you would introduce who you have accompanying you, and then I would then yield to Dr. Kirkpatrick.
Mr. Chairman, I have Dr. Jack Smith with me. He is head of the Clinical and Program Policy and Health Affairs at DOD.
Very good. Thank you. You're now recognized. If you have a written statement, both of you gentlemen, you do?
Yes.
I ask unanimous consent that it be submitted for the record. Hearing no objection, shall be entered. Dr. Kirkpatrick, you're now recognized.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today and discuss the Department of Defense's efforts to prevent, identify, and treat post-traumatic stress disorder. I would like to provide some brief opening comments. I would first like to start by thanking Ms. Pelkey for her courageous testimony today. I would like to also express my sincere condolences to her for her loss. I'm going to be talking about policies and health in the Department of Defense, and in the ultimate evaluation, policies must be evaluated and how well they serve and support our men and women in uniform who serve. When that doesn't happen, then we need to take a look at, is there an issue with the policy or is there an issue with the implementation? And I think that those are areas where we must continue to learn as an organization and as a society. The Department of Defense is firmly committed to safeguarding the health and fitness of our active and reserve component service members, both before, during, and after deployments, and this includes emotional health. The Department's ongoing education programs for military health providers focus on prevention programs and early intervention for behavioral health issues. You've heard about those education programs are still early. We need to have similar education programs for our military leadership, the operational leadership, so that they can support their soldier, sailor, airman, marine getting help early when they need it. We need to make sure that that education program reaches out to touch the families so they are part of this issue on bringing to bear early intervention. And then finally, our service members must understand that they have a safe haven to come to seek that health care. I believe we've made great progress in areas of prevention, identification, and care for stress-related health risks, such as anxiety, depression, and acute stress reaction, and we are really focusing now on post-traumatic stress disorder. These conditions are part of a continuum of mental health issues that are caused by operational stressors and combat trauma. The Department of Defense is making a sincere effort to screen our people for mental health problems annually as part of their preventive health assessment. Service members attend briefing about the psychological challenges of deployment during pre- and post-deployment processing, often with family members. They learn what to expect on homecoming and how to reduce anxiety and family tensions. They also learn to recognize when and how to seek professional help. From the beginning of the current Operation Iraqi Freedom deployment, we employed medical and environmental surveillance to monitor possible health risks. We deployed combat stress teams to provide education and address specific member concerns. At the request of the OIF leadership, the Army sent a 12-person mental health advisory team to Iraq and Kuwait. This was the first time we've ever assessed behavioral health care in the field. Based on the advisory team's recommendations, we deployed additional combat stress teams for the OIF deployed force. In addition to the medical support, members of the chaplaincy provide counseling before departure in the theater and after troops return. Upon their return, service members receive a post-deployment health assessment with a face-to-face discussion with the primary care health provider. The assessment includes specific questions about behavioral health issues associated with deployments. If the individual's responses indicate a risk of behavioral health issues, he or she is referred for medical consultation where PTSD or other behavioral health issues can be identified. Of the 138,000 troops who returned in calendar year 2004 and received a post-deployment health assessment, 16% were subsequently seen by mental health providers for evaluation. We are now implementing the new post-deployment health reassessment program to identify and recommend treatment for deployment-related health concerns that may arise 3 to 6 months after deployment. We're reaching out to veterans 3 to 6 months after they've returned to provide a proactive wellness check to see how they're doing, especially those service members transitioning from active duty to inactive or civilian status. The reassessment begins with a questionnaire that includes questions designed to highlight possible stress-related health issues. Importantly, the questionnaire is followed by a one-on-one consultation with a primary health provider. Again, the professional administering the reassessment will refer individuals to follow-up evaluation when it is indicated. This program certainly requires that education of the primary health care provider so they understand the program, making sure leadership understands this. Dr. Winkenwerter yesterday testified that the Department of Defense has committed $100 million to do this program this year and next fiscal year for the service members who will be in that 3 to 6 month window. After service members return from deployments, military and VA providers use a jointly developed post-traumatic stress clinical practice guideline and the post-deployment health clinical practice guideline to provide focused health care on post-deployment health problems and concerns. There are really algorithms for the care providers to follow to make sure those issues are appropriately addressed. Military members and their families can also proactively seek health care through Military OneSource, a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, toll-free family support service accessible by telephone, internet, and email. Military OneSource offers information and education services, referrals, and face-to-face counseling for individuals and families. This confidential service is especially helpful for those who aren't sure if their symptoms merit medical attention. Their going to Military OneSource does not get reported to their military leadership. If needed, counselors can refer the individuals for suitable care. OneSource is provided in addition to local installation family support services. The National Guard Bureau has recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the Department of Veterans Affairs to promote a seamless transition from DOD to VA. The DOD provides timely data regarding the demobilization of National Guard troops so the VA can provide those individuals with information regarding available care and support. This includes the use of vet centers, which provide professional readjustment counseling and are a link between the veteran and the VA. The department recognizes that stress-related health risks are ongoing threats to our service members, and we must continue to improve our efforts to safeguard their emotional and behavioral health. Our education programs for military and family leaders, for their members and leaders and healthcare providers have been well received. Our early intervention programs, combat stress teams, and health assessments are proving to be effective. All of this has been done in partnership with the VA, bringing us closer to our ultimate goal of a seamless transition from DOD to VA care. Mr. Chairman, I thank you again for inviting me here today. I'm pleased to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me introduce him. My immediate left is Mr. Barlich and then Dr. Shellhorst to his left. Both of these gentlemen have been critically important to us and been heroes in our developing our mental health strategic plan and the implementation of our mental health process, and I'm very proud to have them with me today. Before, sir, I get to my remarks and make a few comments, I also had the opportunity to stop and talk to Mrs. Pelkey, and obviously told her how much I appreciated her courage and dedication and conviction, and told her how sorry I was for her loss. I mean, clearly it's a case, as you articulated, that we should learn from, both DOD and the VA. Sir, just one other thing. I've been in this position since 29 May, but as you know, I was acting in this position for over a year. So I'd like to say I'm no longer acting, but I'm still pretending. Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Nearly every service member who actively participates in combat comes away with some degree of emotional distress. Some have short-term reactions, but thankfully the majority do not suffer long-term consequences from that experience, and we've heard that from the previous panel. Current efforts at early identification of emotional stress by DOD and the VA clinicians increases the possibility of lowering the incidence of long-term mental health problems through a concerted effort at early detection and care. With DOD's help, the VA regularly compiles a roster of service members who have separated after active duty in the Iraq and Afghanistan theaters. VA medical centers have treated over 100,000 of the close to 400,000 OIF-OEF veterans who have separated from active service. Two of the most common diagnoses of health problems that have been cited so far are musculoskeletal ailments and dental problems. However, as was mentioned, we have a drop-down menu, so when the person comes for whatever the issue is, a menu drops down and stimulates the primary care provider to do a mental health assessment to include PTSD. So we've seen nearly, of the people we have seen, the over 100,000, 24,000 have been diagnosed with potential mental health disorders, including adjustment reactions, substance abuse, psychoses, as well as PTSD. Over 14,000 of this group of OIF-OEF veterans have sought VA care at both vet centers and VA medical centers for issues associated with their adjustment reactions, such as PTSD. VA's approach to treating these servicemen and women is guided by an emphasis on the principles of health promotion and preventive care and is in compliance with the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. We focus on providing the patient and the patient's family education about good health practices and behaviors. We believe that education and destigmatization will go a long way in helping people get care and benefit from that. VA is engaged in a number of activities to inform veterans and their families of the benefits and services available to them. In collaboration with DOD, we have emphasis on outreach to returning members of the Reserve and National Guard, and this is a special concern to us and it expanded significantly. In FY 2003, VA briefings reached nearly 47,000 Reserve and Guard members. So far this year, we have briefed more than 68,000 Reserve and Guard members. In addition, both departments have developed a new brochure together, which is entitled A Summary of VA Benefits for National Guard and Reserve Personnel. The VA has distributed over 1 million copies of this brochure. In the interest of time, I was going to comment on the vet centers and the Global War on Terrorism counselors that we've hired, and there were 50 for the first year. We've increased it now to hire another 50, and Dr. Batros commented on that, so I won't reiterate his comments. OIF-OEF returning service members seek out and enter the VA care from a variety of sources, including referral from military treatment facilities, transition assistance program briefings, vet centers, and hometown community service providers. When OEF-OAF veterans present to VA clinicians with mental, emotional, or behavioral complaints, they are assessed both for the symptoms, functional problems, and total clinical needs. Treatment plans may include referral to mental health and vet centers for specific treatment of mental health issues. So as was discussed in the previous panel, there's a tiered approach that people can get to us through our 157 facilities, our 206 vet centers, as well as our 850 CBOCs that are distributed all around the country. The goal of the VA's public health approach is to decrease the incidence of serious mental disorders. There is evidence from VA's initial activities in the field that these approaches are accepted both by clinicians and the veterans they serve. They may well decrease the incidence of chronic mental disorder for veterans. For those who do develop mental disorders, decreasing the stigma of receiving care by teaching the public about the efficacy of evidence-based treatment can increase the beneficial use of these services, whose goal is the restoration and preservation of optimal social and occupational functioning. In conclusion, the VA will continue to monitor and address the mental health needs of OIF-OEF service members. We are prepared to provide the state-of-the-art evidence-based care to all those who come to see us. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I'd like for you to explain a little bit more about this 24,000 of 100,000. We've got to break that number down. That's like saying one in four. Something that doesn't fit right, feel right. I mean, come on, we've all worn the uniform here.
Yes, sir.
We know what it's like to go over there. We know what it's like to come home. We know what the mental adjustments are. It's hard for me to look at my soldiers and say one in four have what?
Oh, well, let me try to answer it a little more thoroughly than I did. As I hope that I was getting across, and I think that the message that we're all saying is that almost everybody who serves has some kind of readjustment or reintegration problem. Most of the time, that's not illness. It's normal reactions to abnormal conditions, and to label this as mental illness would be inappropriate clinically and would be inappropriate for the service member and their family. It's just not a true statement. But of that 100,000 who came, 24,000 had a diagnosis that would be consistent with an adjustment reaction beyond what I just described to you.
Then take the next step. Of the 24,000, then what happens?
Of those 24,000, there's 14,000 of them that have actually got a diagnosis of a mental health thing, and there's a gamut of that diagnosis. Some are adjustment reactions, of which PTSD is one of the adjustment reactions. There can be substance abuse, pure psychosis, acute stress reactions, and they fall into that 14,000 who actually do get a diagnosis under the ICD code.
All right, you got to break this down a lot farther for me, because I don't want there to be any confusion. Of that 14,000, then, break out, however you're coding that, break them out into all the categories. Because if you're including alcoholism, drug abuse, narcolepsy, sleep disorders, sleep apnea, just go down the list. What are we talking about?
Sir, Dr. Shellhorst will get that list. It's by percentage. I believe that, and he'll get that out of the list for you. Just a second. Sir, what I have is the actual most updated, and the number is 15,000 versus 14. And I wasn't trying to be disingenuous. What I put in the statement came before the latest number. Of the numbers of patients who have, and these they can have more than one of the and it's entitled "The Frequency of Possible Mental Disorders Among Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans," adjustment reactions, which is ICD code 309, and I'll be happy to give this to you for the record. There were 15,000 of them who had a potential adjustment reaction, of which. And this is administrative data, as you know, sir, and so you'd have to go back and look at the charts to determine whether they really ended up having PTSD or not, or what kind of adjustment reaction, because you could put down as a primary care internist, if somebody came to me and I was evaluating for their whatever their physical thing was as well as their full evaluation, I might put down rule out PTSD or rule out adjustment reaction, and that gets coded and gets picked up on these numbers. But then you would have to go back and look at the chart to see that if whether I ruled out actually turned out to have PTSD, as I may have referred them to a mental health provider to actually make that diagnosis. But in the administrative data, about 15,000 people have the adjustment reaction. But in that, under the 24,000 of total people who have come that might have mental illness. Under that are non-dependent drug abuse. There's 10,000 people who could have had an adjustment reaction and drug abuse. Depressive disorders are 8,000. affective disorders, 7,000, alcohol dependency, affective psychoses, 4,000, alcohol dependency syndrome, 1,000, sexual deviation disorder, sounds awful, 1,200, special symptoms that are classified, someone, I'd leave it to Dr. Shellis to describe that, about 1,100, acute reaction to stress, 945, and drug dependency, 740.
Thank you for the breakout. Ma'am?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real quickly, what was the 100,000 base? Is that actually identified out of how many?
We categorize people who come that were our OIF, OAS veterans. There were 100,000 people who have come to us so far that had served in the two theaters.
And that's
self-referred? Well, there's a mix of those. Some of them are transfers of care that are, as you may or may not know, the chairman knows very well that we have a lot of seriously injured people that are case managed with the DOD, particularly at Bethesda, Walter Reed, Brooke, Eisenhower, Madigan, and we've also branched out into Fort Hood and Fort Carson and some Navy bases, Marines as well, where we case manage those cases. So they're in that 100,000 as well. Most of them, though, that's a relatively small number. Most of them have come to us for whatever they want because they're veterans and they have a DD-214.
But have you done any outreach to those veterans from the Afghanistan war?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Sorry.
Sorry.
The outreach is a very critical thing for us, both in mental health and whatever the disease may be, because as we've heard from the previous panel, you can have all the infrastructure you want, but if people don't avail themselves of it or know it's there, it's not very productive. And this is particularly challenging in mental health issues because of society's stigma, and we're not immune to that, and people are reluctant to go. So what we've tried to do is be sure through briefings, the BDD process, the TAP, and all these different things, be sure that the separating individual, whether they go back to being a reserve or a National Guard person or they just get out of the active duty and no longer serve, have as much information as possible, understand what the websites are, the 800 numbers. And as we all know, that people remember and keep track very small percentage of what you tell them in briefings, especially when you've come back from a place like Iraq and Afghanistan, and they want to get home. And indeed, as we've learned, it's not required for the National Guard and Reserve to actually go through the process. So a lot of them actually leave the demobilization site without ever getting the thing. So what we've tried to do is be sure that we have videotapes. We've partnered with the National Guard and Reserve, with the states, to go to their sites of where they get back together, to have VBA and VHA counselors go under our Seamless Transition Office, chaired by Colonel Retired John Brown and Major General Retired Matthewson Chapman, who works for him. She's been a leader and a point person on the National Guard and Reserve. But one of the things that we've done is these pocket cards. You know, people lose everything that we give them. We're hoping that people don't usually lose their wallets. So we could give them a pocket card that they could stick in, and if it's 6 months later or a year later, when they're having problems or their spouse is having problems, somebody might remember. Remember that pocket card we gave you?
I don't want to stop you, but
I'm sorry.
In my age, I'm losing it before I can get to the next question, which has to do exactly what you're talking about in regard to the National Guard. Because they are National Guard, and just recently I think we were considering a measure whereby they would only be given 3 months of TRICARE services. If they're not identified at the time that they're mustered out or have not sought help for mental health treatment, does that preclude them from getting treatment at a VA hospital or any other institution that will help them? There's no record of it.
Yeah. Let me say that we're potentially mixing two things. I mean, they get their TRICARE benefit as having served on active duty, and the Department of Defense has extended that to be sure that there was more time for them and their families to get care. But there's a two-year window after you leave, if you served in combat, to come to the VA for anything that came up during that period of time when you served. And with no copays, you're categorized as a Category 6 person, so it doesn't make any difference what your income is or anything like that. And you have that two-year window. After that, they have a DD-214, and they're veterans, so they can come to us any time that they have for whatever they may need.
But it wasn't identified prior to their being released and being mustered out of service. Are they then eligible, still eligible? And I'm thinking of the one. I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the one veteran who didn't recognize he was suffering from PTSD until 20 years later, until he had a group, a mentoring group of other veterans, who had been going through the same feelings, and he found out that he was not alone, and then he sought help. But what happens to that veteran?
Well, we don't just, I mean, with the enrollment management change that took place in the 1990s, 1996, I believe, we changed it that you don't have to have a service-connected illness to come to the VA. Now, having said that, there is one priority that we have that the decision was made if you're a priority 8, and that's developed on an economic basis. But short of that, you don't have to prove connection to be seen. What you might have to prove is connection to get comp and pen, but we still would take care of the person.
Thank you. Dr. Trussman, what DOD data would be most helpful to the VA as you attempt to assess future mental health workload? What would be helpful to you?
Well, as I mentioned in my testimony, we're working very closely with DOD to get as much information as we can, as early as we can. And the comment was made about the post-deployment screen, and I would leave that to Dr. Kirkpatrick. But I believe that they're scanning those and trying to make them electronic and then forwarding them to us, and there's been a great deal of progress on that. It's not perfect. Other pieces of information that we would like to have, whether it's mental health or anything else, is that we've learned clearly with our outreach at Walter Reed and Bethesda with the individuals that have what we describe as polytrauma, that if we're going to be effective in our ability to make this as seamless as possible, and God knows we still have a way to go, but I believe in my heart that we are much better than we were 2 years ago in what we are doing. We would like to know who entered the disability process and when they've in it, so we could then determine if they choose to use the VA. And as you know, sir, the individual gets medically separated or discharged, particularly medically discharged. They have different options. They can continue to use the military system, they can use TRICARE, or they could come to the VA. But if they do want to come to the VA, the sooner we can find out that information, get their comp and pen exam done, get them appointments at the VA so when they leave, they don't fall through the cracks and have to tumble along themselves. And as you know, sir, the VBA has been reasonably good in the past about trying to make sure that at TAP and BDD there was education on non-healthcare benefits. The VA in the past hasn't been as aggressive as we would like to be, and the service member had to show up and knock on the door. But you know, we've changed that, and we're actually partnering and being sure that not only do they get their comp and pen evaluation, but if appropriate, they get the appropriate appointments and get enrolled in the VA long before they actually get their DD-214. As you know also, that we can't provide them anything or give comp and pen to anybody until they're a veteran. They've got to get that DD-214, but the thrust is that everything is in place when they actually get the DD-214 and there isn't a long gap.
Well, I accept your testimony about progress. I mean, I remember Dr. Winkenwerder being over here 2 years ago talking about this. So please convey to Dr. Winkenwerder, he was invited to come here. He came to the Armed Services Committee, chose not to come here. He sent you instead, and I still haven't seen the progress. So you can tell him that for me, okay? Let me yield to counsel for the limited purpose of three questions.
Thank you, Chairman. Looking at VA's own data, in which they look at
evaluation of programs. I believe that's your NEPIC center, the Northeast Evaluation Program, that looks at the mental health service projections. They show that from the first half of 03, fiscal year 03, to now the first half of fiscal year 05, that the VA seen at least a 10% increase in the number of veterans for just the very limited area of outpatient by the special PTSD clinical teams. Those veterans then have generated a 21% increase in the number of visits. VA has been working on a mental health model to do projections for capacity, to identify gaps in services. Did your model accurately project in just even that narrow area a 10% increase?
PTSD symptoms and PTSD diagnoses are actually wrapped into a group within the model, and they're combined with compensated work therapy and some other specialized programs. In hindsight, it would have been advantageous for us to separate PTSD out as a separate entity from that group so we could begin to make the accurate comparisons that you're mentioning. And that will indeed be something we do in a future iteration. So as it stands right now, I cannot tell you that the model predicted X percentage of PTSD diagnoses versus what we actually experience because it's blended with these other diagnostic entities within the group and in the model.
NVA's model that you created basically to identify these gaps, that model does have implications for VA's budget. The first iteration of the model identified deficiencies in mental health service capacity that would require roughly at least $1.6 billion to address the chasm between the demand and the capacity for mental health services, including substance abuse, PTSD, depression, a range of issues. The model was then revised and reprojected. There was a significant drop in the gaps that were identified. In the revision of the model, it was estimated that roughly $700 million, or less than half of the original projection, would be needed to close the gaps by fiscal year 2007. Forgive me. Did the model include projections for OIF and OEF veterans that are coming? And are you now revising it to take into account Colonel Hoag's research and the outcoming research of increase in need for mental health services from returning soldiers?
Let me take a stab at the first part of your question. Yes, it's true that the original assessment was in the numbers that you described. However, when we looked at it critically and reviewed it, and by the way, this wasn't done in a vacuum. It was done with our subject matter experts, including people who work in the NEPIC and are serious with mental ill and all the other groups, found that there were serious flaws in the design to look at that didn't take into account reliance, age cohorts, and things like that, because clearly mental health resources potentially we've seen from historically the Vietnam veteran or thing needs more than the World War II veteran. So that got revised down to $700 million, and it was agreed upon and appreciated by all the people inclined. And as you know, our mental health providers and advocates are not shy, and they certainly would have held us to a much higher level if they didn't agree with that number that was projected. I'll ask Mark about the second part of the question.
The model is essentially run off of data that's 3 years old. So 05 would be run off 02 actuals, 06 would be run off 03 actuals. So by an 02 and 03, we would have seen very little of the influx of patients that we might be seeing in the present from OIF, OEF. The next year's run will take into account 04 data, and so it probably will be a better approximation of the information that you're asking for about what the impact of OIF and OEF will be.
And if I could also add, in addition,
each year the model is revised and refined. Speaking with Barbara Manning this morning, who's one of the people who, you know, works on this, these type of things, you know, come up and need to be projected into the future, obviously, that weren't known at the time of the baseline year. Also along with that, I think it's important to note, too, that one of the other things that is included in that model is what's referred to as VETPOP. And what that is the list of discharges from the service of our potential veteran population. So that information is also blended into these models.
Just to follow up, have you yet revised your 07 projections? Because that was a $700 million number that did not take into account OEF, OIF, or the intensity of their usage of mental health services from VA. Are you revising it for your 07 budget?
Let me try to answer that by saying that we believe that that $700 million was an iterative thing over the course of our efforts to of the strategic plan. And as you know, the undersecretary to kickstart that put $100 million toward that goal in 05 and will be continued in 06. We're developing the 07 budget right now.
There was a DOD-VA collaborative effort to provide clinical practice guidelines to be useful tools. Are they being utilized?
On the DOD side, the use is not what we would like to see. What we are seeing at this point is about 1 to 3% of people coming back, coming into primary care, are answering, yes, I'm here today with a concern that may be related to a deployment. With the numbers of folks coming back, I would expect that that ought to be a lot higher. And so we are taking a look at, with the services, drilling down to say, how is this being used? There are some places you swipe your ID card and you have to electronically answer, have you returned from a deployment? Is this a deployment-related issue? That data is very robust. In some areas, people are actually not asked that. So the policies there, the implementation, is not as robust as we'd like. But currently, we're seeing about 3% of people coming into primary care are indicating this is for a deployment-related issue.
Dr. Cussman?
Sir, as I mentioned to you, that when anybody comes to us and comes to enroll and needs an appointment, part of the protocol is to ask, are you OIF, OEF, because we were giving and are giving them top priority to get in for access to whatever to be sure that they get in with the 30 days, obviously faster if it's urgent or emergent. Also, I mentioned that in our electronic health record, if you come, even if you come for your back pain or headache or arm pain, the primary care provider who sees you, a drop-down menu automatically sets forces the individual practitioner to ask questions related to potential deployment. So, and we also have a very robust employee education system, as you know, that is geared toward educating not only patients but our staff, both doctors, nurses, nurse clinicians, PAs, on the best approaches to PTSD and mental health in general, because quite frankly, you know, nationally there aren't enough mental health providers to provide the full need that the country needs, and so you couldn't rely on the number of psychiatrists and psychologists to do the job. You have to rely on your primary care people to provide appropriate level of mental health care as part of their full service care to their patients. When I was a practicing internist, that was part of my job, to evaluate my patient for mental health. And if I didn't think, or by the guidelines I was using, if that was inappropriate for me to do it, they needed more advanced, then I would refer them on. But you can't treat the full patient without assessing the mental health as well. But again, it's hard to get people to admit that they've got problems, and we go back to the stigma. The particular issue with mental health is that if the individual doesn't recognize that they have a problem, it's particularly challenging to treat them, because if they keep denying the problem, it's hard to force people to get help.
Dr. Cusman, I think we're going to have to come back and maybe do it for another day, and that is I want you to, I'm going to ask of you to become intimate with the IG report, because trying to separate out of all of this, you know, as soldiers and as we are matriculated into a system, a value system and ethos, we don't understand how some would then try to seek to use a system and do fraudulent claims, and we don't like to talk about that. It's sort of like the big elephant in the room that everyone wants to sort of ignore, that there would actually be someone who would deface that value and then try to file fraudulent claims. And the IG has identified a practice going on out there, and websites, and here's how you file your claims, and if you get denied in this particular region, then start forum shopping. And we have this huge mushroom and explosion now of claimants. And what we want to do is make sure that we take care of people who particularly need it, right? I mean, there's a challenge that
we're
confronting here.
Yes, if I could comment on that, because you asked for that in your opening remarks. Obviously, as you quoted, it's a delicate issue, and that we're acutely sensitive and aware of that problem. It's a combined VBA-VHA issue of benefits as well as making the diagnosis. As you know, the Secretary is acutely aware of this, but we're not unique, by the way. In our interaction with our fellow countries that practice medicine and provide benefits like we do, the Brits, the Canadians, the Aussies, and the New Zealanders, are actually seeing the same type of problem exploding with a lot of benefits, particularly mental health benefits, and they're struggling the same way that we are. The Secretary has charged us to look at that critically and make some recommendations to him, and that's what we're starting to do, sir.
When someone receives a 100% disability rating for PTSD, can't they continue to receive treatment and get better so the disability rating could actually go down?
Yes, sir.
But the system doesn't prevent
No, no, sir. It doesn't prevent them from doing it. We encourage them. I mean, obviously, if somebody has 100% disability for any kind of mental health thing, we would presume that ongoing therapy would be a good thing. And if they drop out of service, obviously we can't impact on their course of their events. So
once they get their check and they got their 100% disability rating and now they drop out of treatment, they've achieved a particular goal.
You could, sir, suggest that there were perverse incentives here.
Well, that's what the IG report is indicating with this explosion. It's something we need to look at.
Yes, sir, when we are.
Let me ask this among professionals, and I should have asked the other panel. Is there a reluctance among the practice of psychiatry to really give that second opinion about someone else's diagnosis, or not? Is it pretty free?
I don't think so, but I'll turn to my psychiatrist here.
I'm just curious.
And not to my knowledge. I, in fact, did these exams for many, many years, and we had many remands where we had second opinions or even third opinions. A panel would be required. And they were quite common, no reluctance, no hesitation to give a second opinion, even if it was a different opinion than the original examiner.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, please convey my early remarks to Dr. Winkenwerder. I mean, the reason I came up with pre- and post-deployments was from the lessons learned coming out of the Gulf War and the synergies of my service on Armed Services Committee and here. And so we put a lot of people through these, and then if that data is not being referred on to the VA, then we got problems. And so that, I just want you to know that's very bothersome to me that's continuing to occur. And I want to thank you for your work that you're doing out there, and continue to remain vigilant. And this hearing is now concluded. Thank you.